you to stand and join in the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge of Allegiance.
The flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please call the roll.
Ms. Mauser?
Here.
Ms. Peters?
Here.
Mr. McDavid?
Here.
Mr. Ruffin?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
Mr. Scala?
Here.
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
We have minutes from the regular council meeting of March 7th, 2016. Are there any corrections to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion? Do you have a correction?
I do. I have to abstain from.
Oh, no, this is the minutes. I'm sorry. We're not on the agenda yet.
I'll move to accept the agenda.
For a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Are there any corrections to the agenda?
Mayor, I need to abstain from R-2816.
I move to allow Mr. Trapp to abstain from R-2816. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay.
Mr. Mayor, I need to abstain from R-3116 under the consent agenda due to a conflict of interest.
I move to allow Council Member Nauser to abstain from 3116. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to pull R-3316 off the consent agenda. Probably new business, I think.
The new business. Any other changes?
Yes. Could I ask that we move B-5816 from the consent agenda to old business?
B-5816.
Scala, which bill did you remove?
I did.
Which
one? R-3316.
R-30.
The one about sidewalks and so on downtown.
I'm sorry, was that R-33?
Yeah, that's what it
was. B-5816.
And then the other one that's pulled? R-3316, and what was the second one?
33 and 28 mm-hmm. went to new business. 58 went to old business.
So, Mayor McDavid, you are pulling R-28 to new business, right?
Yes, that's been pulled.
Okay.
May I have a motion and a second to approve the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Welcome. For the rules of testimony during the meeting, there are several opportunities for public comment. After each public hearing, each old business, each new business item, at the end of the meeting is an open comment section where any member of the public can speak for 3 minutes about anything. Each individual is limited to 3 minutes. If you are representative of a specific group that's directly involved in the issue at hand, you may ask for and will be granted 5 minutes. We'll start with appointment to boards and commissions. For the Human Services Commission, there is one qualified applicant. May I have a motion and a second to appoint Peggy Wood to the term ending December 31st, 2018?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. For the Mayor's Council on Physical Fitness and Health, we have three qualified applicants. May I have a motion and a second to appoint Mary Kaysen?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. May I have a motion and second to appoint Michelle Lambert?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. May I have a motion and second to appoint Sherry Riley?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay.
And those will all be for the November 2018.
Yes, that's all for the November 30, 2018 terms. For the Public Transit Advisory Commission, there's one qualified applicant for the student vacancy. May I have a motion and second to appoint Amy Wasowick?
So moved. Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Those who have contacted the city manager's office by noon on Wednesday prior to the council meeting can speak at the beginning of the meeting on any topic not on the agenda. Only two people can speak on the same topic. Tonight we have five requests. I'll yield 5 minutes to the first speaker, Sudhu Forte. Please come forward.
Good evening, everyone.
Evening.
Oh. My name is Sutu Forte, and hello, Your Honor. I live over on, I have the privilege of living on Bluffdale. And please come. I want you to meet some of my neighbors who are here to express their appreciation for something miraculous you did for us last year. This is Ashley Phillips and Louie, Ginger Owens, Susan Brewer, who wrote the letter to send to Barbara Hoppe, which touched you deeply and changed your mind about the sidewalks. This is Brian Kenny. He lives on Southwood. Can you come a little closer? Mihaela Popescu on Bluffdale, my neighbor. This is Jim Green on Bluffdale, Southwood, excuse me, and Brian Johnstone down the street from me, and then my new neighbor, Dan Ferguson. They are here to express their appreciation. We have something for you. You wonderful people receive a lot of, well, I don't mean to offend you, but people don't always like the things that you decide on. I guess it might be called criticism. And we don't believe in that. We believe in praise when it is merited. So as my father told me when I was a little girl, I said, Daddy, what happens when you know that you're right and somebody is wrong, but they decide or they won't change their mind. They won't listen. He says, sweetheart. He says it takes a much bigger person to rethink something, change their mind, than to have to stay stuck in an opinion all the time. And my dad had a lot of wonderful things to tell me when I was a little girl, and I've tried to live by that. And so, okay, so we'll get on with this. Now, this involves you all coming out into the light. So would Mayor McDavid please come this off up your... yes, come over here. And Councilman Carl Scala, could you please come too? Yes, you can. And Councilwoman Laura Nauzer and Councilman Michael Trapp, please. Oh, look, they're here. And you're in the light of glory. And who am I forgetting? We've got everybody. Oh, for God's sake, Ian, I'm so sorry. Mr. Thomas, could you come and join us here? Now, we each have something for you. And Jim, would you kindly give your envelope to... This is for Mr. Scala. Okay. Go up to them. Go up to them. Susan Brewer, could you give, we had these engraved, and there's a special letter inside. This is Susan Brewer. Oh, thank you for being such good sports. Ian Thomas, who has Ian's? And we're still in time. Yes, this is Louie. And Ashley, who do you have here? Okay. And last but not least, my hiking buddy, Michael Trapp. Please, we want you to know how very, very much your open-mindedness and your rethinking that decision was. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Thank you. Thank you so very, very much. Thank you, Mayor McDavid. Congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you so much.
Look, I've still got a minute to blab.
We got a minute to blab.
Thank you all. I want to say thank you to everyone.
That gets it off to a funny start, anyway.
Thank you.
Unique
thank you so
opening to a council meeting.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Let me just say that it is my policy to extend the 5 minutes for people who say nice things about us.
We've never seen that acted.
I wish I would have known that when I was on the other side of the dais.
I'll invite Tracy Wilson Kleekamp to come forward and yield 5 minutes.
That was awesome. I like that. Tracy Wilson Kleekamp with Race Matters. It looks like we're going to be coming up here and thanking Mr. Mathis a lot if we keep this up. So thank you very much for coming to our meeting and listening. We really appreciate that. And it doesn't mean we're going to stop coming to city council meetings and being critical. We're going to probably keep coming. I wanted to say that we sent a thank you note to the city manager, to all of you, sort of wrapping up some of the things we talked about at the meeting, encouraging you to review the prepared report by We Hoyt LLC, Minority and Women-Owned Business Development Project, and talk about it publicly. We thought that was important. We supported what Glenn Cobbins had to say about inReach among white city staff to create a welcoming environment for the inclusion of people of color in city jobs. It's really important to us that leadership and staff are able to address and understand institutional racism in the effort to build meaningful and lasting climate of inclusion. And I'm still wrestling with this idea of balancing interest. I'm concerned when the balance of interest is more important to the people than people who are the most vulnerable and marginalized in our community. So I'm just going to make this quick, I think. Last night we came to campus, Brian Stevenson. If you don't know who he is, he's probably got one of the most well-liked TED Talks out there, number 5 in the world, I'm told. But he has a book out called Just Mercy, and he talks about the criminal justice system. So he had four important points last night, and I'm going to go through them real quickly and try to tie them into Columbia and the issue of social equity. Number one, get closer to the issue. Get closer, have proximity to what's going on. So get into those neighborhoods, ourselves. Not sending other people in, ourselves, you, all of us. Get into those neighborhoods. Get next to the poor folks. Get next to the people that need our help. All right? We have children in schools who need our help. We have social services that are very fragmented. How can we get more proximity to these issues? Two, change the narrative. We have this narrative called the Tale of Two Cities, and we need to change the narrative that people are going to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. We have this mythology about meritocracy, that people can save themselves. We are a village, we are humans, and we are all interdependent on each other. We also need to deal with what I call pathology about people of color. I'm sorry, but this campaign that we see going on right now, where the Klan shows up at rallies and things like that, and if Donald Trump, and I don't usually like to say his name, I usually call him Cuckoo Boy, comes to Missouri, I'm concerned about the behavior and the words that come out of people. So we need to change the narrative about how we talk about people of color, how we talk about black history, how we talk about black people and black bodies. Number three, staying hopeful. Our group are very hopeful, and that's why I said we'll keep coming back. We're persistent. And number four is a commitment to doing uncomfortable things. So I have a minute and 37 seconds to talk about a couple of really uncomfortable things. Number one is that we have to deal with race. We have to be able to talk about it. And number two, we have to deal with process. If we want the black community or any community that's been marginalized to get on board, we should first go and have the conversation with them first. It does not make sense to have a social equity plan. It could be really great, but if the first people to the table aren't, if they're not invited to the table first, we're not building trust in that way. So it's really important for us to think about who's at the table and when we invite them to the table, and if we invite them to the table afterwards, it's really hard to build support on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll yield 5 minutes to Tara Warren Griggs.
Good evening. I'm Tara Warney Griggs. I live in the First Ward, and I'm also here on behalf of Race Matters to discuss Pillar 3 of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, and that pillar is technology and social media. In many ways, the Columbia Police Department is ahead of the curve than in the area of technology. For example, in 2014, Columbia PD was the first department in Missouri to completely adopt body-worn cameras. The department also has very active social media accounts. There are many departments in the country that haven't quite got on board even with that level of effort. The President's task force, however, on page 31 stresses that the adoption of new technology provides police departments an opportunity to fully engage and educate communities in a dialogue about their expectations for transparency, accountability, and privacy. New technology can improve officer safety and performance, increase departmental efficiency and effectiveness, and be used to engage the public in partnership with the police department to improve transparency and legitimacy. To meet these goals, technology must be selected and implemented within a defined framework that is crafted in partnership with the city government and its citizens. The task force directs 4 of the 7 technology and social media recommendations to state and local government and law enforcement agencies. The remainder are addressed primarily to the federal level. The first one is technology adoption and implementation should be based on a local needs assessment to include those with special needs and disabilities, with collaboration from multiple advisory boards. This includes established and public processes for ongoing evaluation of that technology. Number 2, departments should consider adopting smart technology designed to prevent evidence manipulation and tampering. This is also an area where the Columbia Police Department is making moves. Its 2013-2015 strategic plan indicates it intends to adopt a barcode system. But the most recent update to that strategic plan, the dashboard, it shows that no movement's been made on that since 2013. Number 3, update public record laws and practices to address the complex issues that arise around the audio, visual, and biometric data that's collected with new technologies. And number 4, local agencies should adopt best practices for technology-based community engagement to increase trust and access. The task force asserts that crime statistics, service calls, and public posting of policies and procedures represent the bare minimum of that sort of engagement. We have 2 of those 3 on the PD website right now. We call upon the Columbia Police Department to improve its efforts at community engagement, transparency, and partnership. CPD leadership has repeatedly resisted these efforts. For instance, in January 2011, the Columbia Police Review Board recommended that the department upload its policies and procedures online. The chief agreed to do this as long as he could omit the portions that relate to officer tactics in the field. Makes sense. On February 10th of this year, 2016, Race Matters Friends made a public records request for those same policies and procedures, which have not yet been posted online. It's 6 weeks later, and we have a table of contents. Many, many emails back and forth stating why they can't provide us with an actual hard copy of these policies and procedures. This is unacceptable. We have not yet seen actual content. And as John Clark mentioned at the last council meeting, the citizens of Columbia have the right to determine the kind of policing and community engagement they have. We need to work together to improve the ways in which technology can be used to improve policing and improve community relations. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll yield 5 minutes to David Tager.
Good evening, and thank you all for the chance to speak. I'm David Tager. I'm also with Race Matters Friends. Within a week of moving to Columbia in 1996, I first heard a European American say, race is not an issue here. Where is that paradise, that place where individuals are not judged on their skin color? I've lived in Ohio, New York, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, Missouri, Italy, and Mexico without ever glimpsing anything close to this ideal. The human brain uses categorization and associations, biases based on social training and experience as shorthand to make all sorts of instant judgments, and they often fly in the face of our conscious beliefs. As the Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman puts it, the brain has two modes of thinking, fast and slow. Our brains are constantly sorting through an elaborate tangle of sensory input from the environment in order to maximize our chances to survive and thrive. You're all familiar with fight, flight, or freeze reactions that occur when we face danger. Sensory input is categorized, and our bodies react long before we have a chance to consciously weigh the evidence of what is happening around us. This is fast thinking, which is the norm rather than the exception, the basis by which we make most of our judgments. But the pattern of input that constitutes danger for our fast-thinking brains is shaped by cultural experience. Thus, when a bear is spotted in national parks, the most common agitation is not people fleeing or grabbing the nearest weapon, but reaching for their cameras and moving closer for the cutest photo. That's not what happens when you run across a young African-American male in the streets of a city. Using the metaphor of the moral psychologist Jonathan Haidt, the fast-thinking brain is a lumbering elephant, while the slow-thinking brain is a rider who can, with training and effort, turn the elephant in a direction that runs counter to ingrained bias. So the Academy of Motion Pictures may believe in equity, yet manage only to see the work of European Americans as worthy of Academy Award nominations. We know from a strong body of research that similar biases, sometimes conscious but often unconscious, play out consistently in the marketplace for employment, housing, education, and even goods and services. Just to name a couple of examples, when we take the exact same fictional resume and submit it to advertise jobs under two different names, John and Jamal, for example, John is contacted significantly more for interviews. Or in a study of 242 car dealerships, fictional car buyers were quoted sales prices that differed solely on the basis of race and gender. European American men were offered prices $1,000 less than African American men, who were charged the most. European American women were after European American men, and then African American women. The elephant of racial stereotypes is right before our eyes and difficult to steer. We can consciously disavow stereotypes of African Americans as lazy, less intelligent, criminal, and aggressive, but these stereotypes are part of fast thinking nonetheless. The result is decision making that unconsciously and sometimes consciously restricts access for African Americans to employment, education, justice, health care, housing, and basic equitable treatment. The statistics are overwhelming. You could fill a day-long workshop. African-American incomes, education, life expectancy are lower, poverty and incarceration higher. We can't deny the systemic gap by pointing the fact that we have had one African-American president out of 44. The explanations for the gap are either to reinforce racial stereotypes that go back to slavery by saying that African-Americans as a group are in fact somehow lazy or less intelligent, dangerous, or culturally unprepared for modern life, or we can acknowledge that negative images of African Americans are trained into our brains by historical events, present-day cultural narratives, and media images to the point that our fast thinking results in systematically charging African Americans more for the same car. And once we recognize the pattern, we can do a lot to train ourselves to steer the elephant instead of simply being carried. That's the purpose of training, to ingrain responses based on awareness rather than settling for biased associations of fast thinking. This is what happens in every profession. You get trained in how to handle tough situations. We need consistent, sustained training all throughout the city on the issues of race and how to deal with them and how to handle them. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll yield 5 minutes to Arnie Fagan. We'll move to public hearings. Please read PH 9-16.
Public hearing 9-16 is the consideration of the FY 2015 Consolidated Annual Performance and Evaluation Report, CAPER.
Staff, please.
Good evening. Another year, and we have another CAPER for the City Council. That's an acronym that stands for Consolidated Annual Performance Evaluation Report. The acronym is creation of the Department of Housing and Urban Development that annually provides the city with the Community Development Block Grant and the Home Investment Partnerships Grant. So this is a report of fiscal year, or excuse me, calendar year 2015, which is the first of 5 years of the city's consolidated plan, which is another of the products that we're obligated to provide to housing and urban development. And with us is Housing Program Supervisor Randy Cole, and he's going to take you through the report. And I'll just remind everyone that this is a public hearing. We will receive comments not only tonight, should someone want to make a statement for the record, but until the end of this month, persons can write us care of the City of Columbia at 701 East Broadway, or they can send them by email to planning@gocolumbiamo.com. Mr. Cole?
Sure. So the CAPER summarizes community development block grant and home accomplishments for our program, our fiscal year 2015, which is calendar year January to December 2015. It's due to HUD by March 31st. The purpose of tonight is to collect public comment, as Tim stated. All expenditure and funding commitment requirements for both CDBG and home were achieved in 2015 as required by HUDs. Some project highlights. We completed the design, a significant completion of the design of three sidewalk projects. That's Worley Intersections, Garth, and Alita Boulevard. Services for Independent Living had another great year with some high production of 21 homes. Job Point had a great year also, utilizing some of our CDBG funds in training 14 participants. We've seen significant progress over on Lynn Street. The biggest highlight for this past year was our increase in the homeownership assistance program. We had 29 homes. That's the most we've done since I've been here. We spent about $250,000 in home and CDBG funds combined, which leveraged about $2.9 million in private mortgages. Phoenix programs renovations and expansion were completed this past year, as well as Reality House renovations. We demolished three vacant and dilapidated properties at the addresses listed below. And we also completed the Affordable Housing Symposium, which was greatly attended with about 135 attendees. This just shows our CDBG expenditures dating back to 2007. We've done a really good job of narrowing our gap of what we carry over year to year for CDBG and our expenditures. Home, there's a little bit wider gap still. We have some projects that are multi-year, but we did meet all of our expenditure requirements. Our internal housing program production, the large bar over there on the right is our homeownership assistance program labeled as HOA. You can see it's a really big increase from what we've done in years past. And right now we're on track to exceed that in 2016. We didn't really slow down much at all during the winter months. Had another good year for the demolition program. Had a slight increase in our rehab. Our minor home repair program was down. Both rehab and minor home repair over historical rates were slightly down. We did lose one staff member in the middle of last year, but we are fully staffed up now, and I anticipate a really good year for both those programs in 2016. So this gives you a picture of all of our different goals that we do within our five-year consolidated plan, and shows the percentage of funds expended that correlate to the goals per each different funding item. So every goal that we have for a person trained through the vocational training or a rehab project completed or a bus shelter completed has an associated dollar value, so you can see how far along we are at the end of year one with that first dotted line at 20%. So you can see the home buyer assistance, we're almost halfway what we would plan to do in 5 years. We're a little ahead of the game on the vocational training, as well as our construction of new houses and removal of dilapidated houses. There's a couple of items like the bus shelters and the sidewalks where we look behind, but this year we'll knock out a majority of those, or all of our bus shelters, so we'll hit our five-year goals in that year. With that, that's a quick summary of the paper, and I'll answer any questions.
Any questions from council? I'll open the public hearing. Would anyone like to speak?
No.
All
John Clark, 403 North 9th Street. I was here in support of the Race Matters Group. My reason for standing up is to ask Randy and Tim to remind you about the event on April 8th, the fair housing thing. This is a four-hour thing. Mm-hmm. This is a big deal. I mean, I frankly don't think we've done enough for years. It was one of the things that was called for when we did the housing market analysis stuff in 2004, which you probably can't even find on the website longer because we've taken so long to implement things. But this is a significant step forward in what we're doing in the education of people and the public, in training and the participation. Would you like to say more to explain to people? Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, we have the Fair Housing Symposium. Rose Wibmeyer with the legal department has really been the driver in organizing this. She does a lot of all the fair housing activities that we fund through CDBG. But we're going to hear from a variety of speakers on fair housing laws and rights, what individuals can take away from it, as well as if you're a landlord or property manager or realtor. I'll also be providing a presentation on fair housing and what HUD regulations, what changes there have been with what cities have to do in regards to fair housing.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to speak? We'll close the public hearing. Council discussion.
Okay. I just want to ask a question of the staff. I noticed you were talking about bus shelters, and I certainly appreciate bus shelters and with our transit emphasis that we have. This was a percent of five-year goal, so that was a 20% estimate. So that suggests that there'll be 25 new bus shelters over the course of, is it? I mean, where does this fit in terms of CAPER paying for some
sure.
of these? And
let me explain that chart. The five bus shelters would lead you to 100%. So
okay.
I've
right.
just broke out the expenditures for five shelters would be about 25. We're going to do five of them, so it'd be about $20,000 per shelter.
And this is the CAPER. This is what the CAPER is responsible for bus shelters. We have more in the budget that are coming
yeah.
down the line.
Yeah.
I just want to make that distinction.
We allocated funds for 2016. We haven't received those funds yet, but there's $100,000 for bus shelters, which will do the five that are listed there. So by the end of 2016, that should be at 100%.
Great. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Any other discussion by council? This requires no action. Please read PH 1016 and B 5516.
Public hearing 1016 is the consideration of phase three development of the Thomas E. Country Adkins Jr. Memorial Park Baseball Complex to include construction of two baseball fields and the installation of lighting, additional parking, walkways, and an irrigation pump station in Deep Well. Council Bill 5516 is an ordinance determining it is in the public interest to proceed with phase three development of the Thomas E. Country Adkins Jr. Memorial Park Baseball Complex to include construction of two baseball fields and the installation of lighting, additional parking, walkways, and an irrigation pump station in Deep Well, approving and adopting plans and specifications, determining that a portion of the work shall be done by contract, calling for bids through the purchasing division, determining that a portion of the project shall be done by city employees, providing for payment for the improvement, authorizing the city manager to obtain, execute, and record all documents necessary for the improvement, providing for compliance with the prevailing wage law and state mandated construction safety training, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. We're requesting approval to complete the final phase of improvements to Adkins Park. The project is $650,000 and is funded by the dedicated park sales tax from our last ballot in November. We have it split over 2 years of $575,000 in this year and then $75,000 in FY17. The improvements will finish out the complex as approved by the master plan adopted by council on April 17, 2007. Adkins Park is an 81-acre park donated generously by Thomas E. Country Adkins. It's a joint ownership with the county and the city. It's located just north of the Central Missouri Events Center in Ward 3. The department's requesting a this final phase will do two lit fields with a playground, irrigation well and pump station, an additional 168 parking spaces to accommodate the growth of the two new fields. Once the fields are completed, staff will construct amenities such as a batting cage, walkways, the security lighting, egress lighting, things like that. Work is going to begin this summer with the fields going to be completed by fall of 2016. We had an IP meeting at the ARC on January 21st with an online survey. We met with our Diamond Council, which is our partner agency for youth sports and baseball and softball, as well as Columbia College and the BC Baseball Organization, which are our other two primary users. Our commission endorsed the project at their January 21st meeting. Following the public hearing, staff requests that council approve the ordinance authorizing the project to proceed. Questions?
Council, would anyone from the public like to speak? Seeing none, council discussion, let me just say that, as usual, Parks and Rec made a promise and kept it, and this is a fabulous facility, one that we all should be very proud of. It's going to be a great facility for Boone County citizens, plus it's going to be the site of regional tournaments, too, and we'll help pay some of the bills with tax money spun off by visitors to Columbia. So I'm proud to support this.
Yeah, and just let me add to this. This is kind of a third ward park. I'm proud to support this as well. This kind of fits into our city strategic plan when it comes to equity, in this case, parks equity, and it fits with social equity and racial equity and all the rest of it. I think there is something tangible that we're doing now that folks can see that we're very serious about this, and this is a piece of that puzzle that fits in very nicely with that whole overall plan. So thanks a lot for the kudos to the Parks Department as usual with their usual good job.
And I would just add that baseball fields make us more competitive to be able to host tournaments, which helps us fill hotel rooms in the off season, which is really valuable for our economy. We build them for the big sports weekends and Mizzou events, and then we have to do events and look for ways, including sports tourism, to fill those, to bring folks in. So this is all part of how parks add value to everybody in the community, even for those small percentage of folks who don't utilize parks directly, they still benefit.
Please call the roll on B5516.
Council Bill 5516, Ms. Nauzer.
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Please read PH 11-16.
Public hearing 11-16 is a voluntary annexation of property located on the southwest corner of Wyatt Lane and Wilson Turner Road.
Staff?
This is an annexation public hearing for two lots that are located at the southwest corner of Wilson Turner Road and Wyatt Lane in Northeast Columbia. Subject site is indicated on the location map that you have in your packets. Two lots that are zoned County RS, which is equivalent to the city's R1 single-family detached zoning district. These are two different owners that desire connection to the city sewer. The lots are contiguous to the city boundary, which is at Wyatt Lane on the east. It is also contiguous on the south and partially to the west, basically the subdivisions that you see in the image that are served with sewer. Those are those are within the city limits. Wilson Turner Road serves a subdivision of large estate-sized lots, and that's outside the city's jurisdiction. There'll be no change in the status of Wilson Turner Road. It will remain a county-maintained roadway over its length. And Wyatt Lane is and will remain maintained by the city in this vicinity. This is in the urban services area in the Columbia Imagined Comprehensive Plan. There is a companion bill that is being introduced in your agenda, as indicated in the parentheses on the agenda, and that will be to consider the permanent zoning of R1 on this property at your next meeting. I'll try to answer any questions you may have.
Just one question. I guess we're having a third ward theme, which is okay with me. but it seems like there will be another lot there. Does that create a part of the county island with these two lots to the north of it? Is there one lot south, which is a different owner, I take it? Or?
Well, I believe, unless we made an error, that's shown as R1, so that is within the city.
That's within the city.
And I'm sorry that the exhibit I have was not clear.
It just looked like
this shows the zoning. Is that the lot you were referring to? That large, yeah, is a comparable,
right,
size lot.
Right, right.
Yeah, that, and I noticed it was connected to sewer as well. That must have been
okay. That's what I wanted to clarify, because we have some issues with county islands within the city. And
yeah, and we'd rather not create islands through these actions. Yeah. So I appreciate the question. Thank you,
Tim. I apologize if you mentioned this. I didn't catch it. I assume that this property is within the urban service area.
Yes, sir. It is.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak?
Good evening, Mayor and Council. My name is Kevin Murphy. I'm with Ace Civil Group. Offices at 3401 Broadway Business Park Court. I'm here representing the Mr. and Mrs. Durnell and Mr. Auk, who own these properties. And to answer Mr. Scala's question, yes, that property immediately to the south is what is in the city limits and makes Mr. Auk's property, the vacant property, contiguous, and then the Durnell's. I think the staff report covered it pretty well. I would like to add that we over-designed this sewer for a potential grab up to, it gets a bit hilly in here, so it'll be a forced main type sewer, but we upgraded that to the northern boundary to allow for 30 plus homes to attach to that. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
So the city's sewer system is already in place and adequate?
Yes, ma'am. It's across, okay, from Opal Drive.
Okay.
Public Works or Sanitary Sewer Utility has approved the construction plan, so I assume that is the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Close the public hearing. Any council discussion? If not, please call the roll.
I don't believe there's any action on this item.
Oh, until it comes up later for the rezoning.
We'll move to old business, B4816.
Council Bill 4816. Is an ordinance authorizing a real estate purchase and sale agreement with St. Charles Road Development LLC for the acquisition of 15.88 acres of land adjacent to the Lake of the Woods golf course, directing the city clerk to have the agreement recorded and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
Thank you, Mayor. Parks and Recreation was requesting approval to purchase just about 16 acres of land adjacent to Lake of the Woods golf course, as shown here in this yellow box. The acquisition price is $20,000 per acre for a total of $317,600. This acquisition is funded by the 2010 Park Sales Tax Annual Park Acquisition Fund. The land is currently undeveloped with a history of agriculture. As you can see from this image, it's been farmed for most of its tenure. Originally intended to be a 52-unit housing development, part of Somerset Village. Our planned use is to make it as part of a driving range, is to construct that on the site. There's many factors and benefits to this, including land preservation, making Lake of the Woods a full-service golf course. It'll generate about $35,000 to $45,000 per year in revenue. We'll be able to offer more clinics, camps. We have significant school requests for use of our golf course, and this driving range will open up some more areas for the schools to use. It'll be comparable then to L.A. Nickel, providing equity on each side of the Columbia. The lessons will be a critical point, as well as soliciting private tournaments. We lose a lot of private tournaments because we don't have a driving range. And having this driving range at Lake of the Woods will make us more competitive. And by just the fact of having a driving range, we'll probably see increased rounds on our golf course. There are some things we're going to do to work with the neighborhood development. We will build a walkway to connect to Somerset Village. That walkway will come from our clubhouse around through the here, connecting to the tee box and all the way out up to the Corey Drive and Armstrong Drive intersection. We'll have a gate there. Our staff will open and close that gate when the course is open. It'll be part of just opening the gates up as we do for normal operation on St. Charles Road. We'll also not have any golf or driving range activities after 10 p.m., which we won't light the course or that driving range for the next 10 years. And then driving range construction, we will fund that as FY17 with our golf course improvement fee, which is a fund that is generated purely by golfers. It can only be used for golf. We'll do an aggressive tree planting buffer along the north section here to help create that buffer and maintain this tree preservation in the area here. After this acquisition and some of the other ones we were talking about, we will still have a balance of $940,000 for other council priorities as they should may arise. Believe it or not, when I came on with the department in 1984, we were thinking we were going to expand Lake of the Woods back then in 1989. We tried to acquire this 90 acres, which is just to the west of this property. It included about a 15-acre Welch Lake. Our goal at that time was to add 9 holes, all for the price of $95,000 at the time. We did not do it because the motion died for lack of a second by city council, and so we did not acquire that. We have been approached by the property owner to look into it again, and we have asked our Greenbelt Land Trust to score this tract based on the qualities of land preservation as per their natural legacy plan. So with that said, our council concurs that the acquisition is appropriate. We request ordinance authorizing manager to execute the real estate purchase and sale. Questions?
A couple questions. Again, you emphasize this is not a lighted driving range.
Correct.
And secondly, clarify that the golf courses pay for themselves on user fees and do not require a taxpayer subsidy.
Correct.
And that you will generate enough revenue from user fees in the driving range to pay for the driving range, and you anticipate more user fees from the golf course because this is adjacent to it. Is that correct?
That is true.
Yeah, this at the outset, this seems like another potentially advantageous amenity for the golf course. So now it's in keeping with this third ward theme tonight, I guess, that we have. And you mentioned some of this other property. I know we're in very, very preliminary stages of talking about this, but this does have a potential, given assuming that that the city council may, in fact, we have enough funds and so on, go along with this, that it could be a kind of another Cosmo Park East. Given this 90 acres and with the golf course and everything else, this has tremendous potential. Do you see it that way? I mean,
it certainly does. There's room there that you could put a neighborhood park amenities on the northwest corner of the new tract, as well as trails and connectivity and all that. So yes.
And this is right in between where the city limits are and Battle High School as well. It's in that neighborhood, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Seeing none, council discussion. Please call the roll.
Council Bill 4816, Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters? Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Please read B4916.
Council Bill 4916 is an ordinance approving the final plat of Somerset Village Plat 3, accepting the dedication of rights of way and easements, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
Well, this is a little anticlimactic. You just heard the planned use of this property, but this is simply the subdivision plat that makes it a unit of real estate. And probably the only thing I'll explain here is why the two lots, during review of what was proposed to be a one-lot plat for the driving range, it was suggested by some of the reviewing parties that we make some form of reservation of future access. You may have noticed during Mr. Griggs' report there was an image in orange line that showed the planned Somerset Village subdivision extending a street to this tract. The use of the driving range does change that. So it was thought that by creating a creating kind of a dog ear on the northwest corner and reserving that in the event the Welch Lake tract that was discussed needed independent access, that a second lot could be created. We're not suggesting that any road must be built or will be built, but this would be a way to facilitate access should the subdivision pattern, not only to the west but to the north, require that. So with that, I'll try to answer any questions you may have about the plat.
Any questions from council? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Seeing none, any further discussion by council? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 4916, Ms. Nowzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Please read B5116.
Council Bill 5116 is an ordinance granting a variance from the requirements of Section 2548.1 of the City Code relating to construction of a sidewalk along a portion of the Providence Outer Road frontage adjacent to Rockbridge High School, subject to a condition, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
This is a request by Columbia Public Schools, represented by ES&S. Engineering consultants, Representative Mr. Tom Trabue. Sorry, I'll pay for that later. Yeah. Mr. Tom Trabue is their representative tonight, and the location is 4303 South Providence Road. This is approximately 1,630 lineal feet of frontage along the Providence Outer Road. Of course, the Rockbridge High School and Career Center campus is well known. Has been developed for decades. Columbia Public Schools has continued to improve the property, and in their most recent submission for building permits, we informed them that we had no record of a sidewalk variance, and one is required by the letter of the ordinance, or a sidewalk must be built. So they took that request to the Planning and Zoning Commission. The commission heard their arguments, which staff, frankly, concurred with really the only exception. We felt that some kind of alternative that provides better connection to the existing Providence pedway would be perhaps a useful trade-off. And I think the Columbia Public Schools did concur with that. And so following a public meeting to consider the variance, the Planning and Zoning Commission did recommend the variance unanimously with the condition that a new trail connection be provided. And this would be a view of the Career Center, and on the south side of it just showing really a crosswalk type walkway that would provide another point at which that existing trail that was built with Getabout funding could be connected to, and that would facilitate pedestrian movement in and around the campus. I'll try to answer any questions council may have.
Any questions from council?
I have a real quick question. Was it discussed at all? That roadway can get rather busy at times throughout the day. Was there ever any discussion about a crosswalk at that area? So that students
across crossing the outer roadway?
Yes, so that students can safely cross South Providence.
I think that's the idea here, where the ends of the improvement are shown, there would be a crosswalk markings.
Will there be one of the ones that have the electronic, the push button, so that you can signal the traffic?
I can't say that we discussed that, like a hawk signal,
yes,
kind of thing. Yeah, I don't think we've discussed that. I think
is there one on the other side on Southampton? I can't remember.
I think there's caution lights on there. There is a pedestrian button, I believe, that activates caution lights.
Okay, so I mean that certainly could be something we can have a conversation about later, but that certainly would be an appropriate spot for such a crosswalk for the students to have safe access to the trail.
Any other questions?
Yeah, this proposed connector comes from the Career Center, and I very much agree with your suggestion, Laura. There should be a visible crosswalk there so that the students can cross the outer road safely. But what about further south at the high school itself? How will those students coming out of the high school connect to the trail? Was there any discussion of a similar kind of connector from the other building?
I think the possibilities were considered. There is, you know, ditch drainage there. There's a number of topographic obstacles and where the pathways or improvements could be built out of right-of-way. They're displacing other improvements, so there was concern about that.
Concern about building a connector like this
whether it could
at
be,
the other building?
Yeah, whether it could be accommodated given the physical conditions there.
Well, it seems to me that if we're giving the school district the variance because we've already built a trail there, relieving them of the burden of building the sidewalk, they really should make a proper connection, especially from the high school building itself, which I think has a whole lot more students in it, typically, than the Career Center.
Can you go back to that to the other picture, the close-up? Is the Career Center? That's not the front of the high school? Because that looks like the high school to me. It is the Career Center?
That's the Career Center.
Okay.
It would be flipped around if there were the high school. There's a cutout would be towards Providence.
Okay.
That's one of two parking lots for the high school students.
You know, we're not in comments yet, are we?
No, questions. But again, access to that crosswalk would be on pavement, but it would be through the parking lot from the school, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there is connectivity. It's just that it's not dedicated connectivity. You have to go through the parking lot.
I mean, there's some walkway in front of the building, but and then there's walks that go directly to the parking lots, but it's really just something to provide a little bit of a landing off of the drive aisle through the parking areas.
How was that area decided on? Because to me that looks like you wouldn't really want to have students crossing right where kids are turning left onto the outer road or going straight. Was there any discussion about putting it in the middle?
I think some of it's spacing because I believe there's a crossing farther south. And then topography is a major factor in this. And trying to keep it at an intersection rather than at a spacing where you may have vehicles committing to their turns as kids are walking across the street. If they can be seen at the corner, it's really safer because the vehicle won't commit to the turn then if they see that there's someone awaiting to use the crosswalk.
Is that already a trail connector further north than the proposed one, connecting from the main trail to the outer road just at the more northerly driveway entrance? But there is one connector there.
Well, I was thinking of one south, and I think Mr. Trabue will address that. He did make remarks on the existing conditions to the Planning and Zoning Commission. I just don't have the overview map to show you where all the existing
If there are no more questions, I'll open to the public.
Mr. Mayor, Council, thank you for hearing me this evening. I appreciate the questions. I think I'll probably address almost all of them. Great questions. As indicated, my name is Tom Trabue with Think McClure Engineering Company with offices at 1901 Pennsylvania Drive here in Columbia. As Tim indicated, we are the engineering consultant working on behalf of Columbia Public Schools. Have some slides that'll show a little bit better. So, as the staff report indicated, CPS is intending to make several improvements at Rockbridge High School. They're indicated on the overhead that you have. They were doing maintenance upgrades and renovations to the main entry plaza. As was indicated, the Rockbridge High School was built over 40 years ago, and the entry plaza could use a little bit of an upgrade, and so we're going to do that for the students there. Second is accessibility improvements at the baseball and softball field back on the west side of the property. If you've ever used that facility, those are gravel trails going back to the baseball and softball facilities, and we will be paving those to make them more accessible for the students, students and parents. And then thirdly, the major project is replacing the existing football press box, grandstands, concessions, and the associated pedestrian plaza. And again, this is to upgrade the facility and bring it more into equity with the other two high schools. If you may recall, we did a similar project at Hickman High School a few years back. The site improvements are maintenance improvements, and we don't believe as such would have triggered the sidewalk requirements. The press box, grandstands, and concessions are considered accessory buildings, not new buildings, and therefore would not trigger the sidewalk requirements outlined in Chapter 24. And of note, the north addition to the high school was constructed in the late 1990s. The career center expansion was constructed in 2009. The gymnasium expansion was constructed in 2011, and none of these expansions triggered the requirements for the sidewalk to be constructed along this frontage. Nonetheless, we are here to ask for the variance to the ordinance requiring construction of a sidewalk along the east side of the property. As been mentioned, in 2011, the city completed the South Providence Trail, which extends from Green Meadows Road to Old Plank Road. This is a paved concrete all-weather trail, actually a significant improvement to the pedestrian connectivity and bicycle connectivity in that part of the city. Connections were strategically made along the way to properties and connecting streets along the west side of South Providence Outer Road. Along the corridor from Green Meadows Road to Southampton Drive, every property has been developed. There are currently only two parcels in this corridor with sidewalks on this side of the outer road. It is very unlikely that any of these properties will be subject to redevelopment in the foreseeable future. I have prepared a few slides and photos of the overall project, which I think will answer some of the questions that you've had. The first slide shows the entire length of the project. On the left side is the Career Center, the high school in the middle, and then the south parking lot, Southampton Drive on the east side. Along the upper side is Providence Road. As Councilman Thomas indicated in one of the photos, there is a trail connection at the very north end of the property, on the north edge of the Career Center. There is a trail connection at the main high school entrance, and I do have some photos of that as well. And then there is also a trail connection down at Southampton. So we think we've got some good connectivity between the South Providence Trail and the school site. To further expand on that, a little bit of a blow-up of the north end of that with the trail connection. You can see that. We've also noted on this the driveway right there toward the bottom of the photo. That's right at the crest of the roadway. So if you're familiar with that area, the crest of the roadway is right at that entrance. It's a perfect place for good site visibility. Right now, the northern trail connection is not a very good location. When there is a lot of traffic on that roadway, people are zipping up over that hilltop, and if somebody was in that crosswalk there, that would probably be a dangerous situation. Moving farther south, and this is just moving down, you can see the north addition of the high school, one of the new parking lots, the rain garden that's there. Nothing real special in that photo. This is the main high school, and you can see the trail connection that is there for the main connection. I think that was a question that Mr. Thomas had. And then continuing on to Southampton, this is really, although there are several reasons, but this is really the primary reason that the school district is looking for a variance. There is a very deep drainage ditch in that corner. We've got a number of utilities in that corner. There is really not a reasonable solution to building a sidewalk and making a positive connectivity in that area. In order to do that, would require a pretty large fill, drainage pipes. We'd have to relocate utilities. There's telephone poles. There's telephone pedestals, et cetera, and that other. I do have a number of other photos that I'd be glad to show you, but in the interest of time, I'm going to go right to the meat of it, if you don't mind. By nature of our audience and customers, Columbia Public Schools are supporters of providing appropriate pedestrian access in our community. Construction of a sidewalk along this frontage is going to be difficult and costly. There's not a reasonable solution for the southern connection, which is shown in the photo, And we do not believe the construction of this sidewalk will add value to the community. And we're kind of saying that based on the investment that's already been made by the community in the South Providence Trailway. We believe that granting of this variance makes sense for several reasons. We believe that this is a unique situation. The South Providence Trail provides adequate north-south pedestrian and cyclist connectivity for this property and beyond. Connection points were strategically installed with the trail construction, as have been shown. Constructing a parallel sidewalk on the west side of the outer road would seem to be redundant and unnecessary at this time. We believe that the connectivity from the school site to the South Providence Trail is adequate. Due to the grades along the outer roadway, constructing an appropriate sidewalk will require a fair amount of excavation and cutting in an already established utility corridor, resulting in displaced utilities and the resultant disruption and cost. The deep drainage ditch and overall topography of the property and the right-of-way at the outer road and Southampton intersection preclude a reasonable construction of a sidewalk in this area. We believe that the appropriate sidewalk solution along this outer roadway, if done, should be done correctly with the utmost safety for students and visitors, considering on-street parking, curbs and gutter, and storm drainage improvements that can't all be accomplished at this time. Based on the approval of past building additions under the same ordinance, CPS was confident that the sidewalks along this frontage were a non-issue and, quite frankly, did not budget for what is now anticipated to be an $80,000 to $100,000 cost. While we believe that a sidewalk is not required along this frontage, as was indicated in the staff report, we've carefully reviewed the function of the South Providence Trail as it relates to the connectivity to the school and most notably to the Career Center. As indicated in the photos, we already have a great connection from the main entrance of the high school, but we did see a gap in the connectivity between the South Providence Trail and the Career Center. And so we would like to, actually I have a few other photos of that south area. So again, this is the slide that was in the staff report. We are proposing to make a connection, an ADA accessible connection from the South Providence Trail. That's on the right side of the outer roadway. There will be a striped crosswalk, and then we will build sidewalks as shown to make the connectivity to the Career Center. So we feel like by doing this, we've made the connectivity at the Career Center. We already have a really good connectivity at the main entrance of the school and good connectivity at Southampton Drive, and we think this will satisfy the concerns of good pedestrian and bicycle connectivity in the area. I'd be glad to clarify any points or answer any other questions you might have. As indicated, I do have photos up and down the entire outer roadway, but most of you all are pretty familiar with that area anyway. But again, I'd be glad to show you whatever. Yes?
I just had a question, and that is, you know more about the traffic patterns there than I do, but and you've indicated the crosswalks, which provide the connectivity. Is any of this pedestrian-activated signalization, do you think, is an added benefit in terms of student safety and so on?
Actually, at this particular location, I don't believe so. I don't think that pedestrian activity would warrant it. We are trying to place this, again, we're placing this at a location where we have the highest site visibility possible from all directions by putting it at the crest of the roadway.
I mean, I'm becoming a real fan of those things, even the downtown. I think those activated flashing lights, you can even see them in the fog from
right.
a long way. It's
right.
really kind of amazing. But
yeah, I think I've got an example of this is the crosswalk that is existing for the main entrance. And we spent a fair amount of time down there, you know, watching it, taking a look at it, and it seems to perform very well. It is right at the inlet into the bus drive, and so there is a fair amount of traffic at that location. You know, quite frankly, we're dealing with high school students, although I think Councilman Thomas, I'm looking right at you, I think you'd like to see a lot more bicycles at the high school. We're seeing an awful lot of cars. You know, that's just the mode they use today.
So the new sidewalk and crosswalk will look a lot like this.
It'll be very similar to that. And with the signage and striping, we will have advanced signage. We just won't have the hawk signals that have been discussed. So we will have that. This particular one has kind of an elevated bed. We would not anticipate doing that at the other location because of where it is on the crest of the hill and immediately adjacent to the exit for that drive. We think that would cause some difficulties.
And did you say that you would create two crosswalks, one on the Career Center property and then the one across the outer road itself?
Yeah, well, there would be one crosswalk across the outer road, and we will create connection from that crosswalk to the South Providence Trail,
mm-hmm.
and we will also build the sidewalks to make that connection back to the Career Center front door.
And then there's an internal driveway. Will you paint a crosswalk there as well?
Yes, we will paint a crosswalk on that drive as well.
Mm-hmm. And you'll paint this crosswalk on the city road here?
In conformance with the city traffic engineers.
And then I guess we'll be responsible to repaint it and to maintain it in the future.
Yes, that would be correct.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tribune. Anyone else? Close the public hearing. Comments from council? Discussion?
Well, this is in my ward, and so I appreciate the slide presentation that certainly answered some questions. So now that my son is no longer in high school and is in college, I don't get over there very often, so it was a nice refresher on the days I used to have to pick him up from school. And so I think what you've presented with the crosswalks and the signs, I think, as you said, for high school students should be adequate for their safety and to alert people in their automobiles that there is a crosswalk in that area. And when we first put in that trail, I think one of the highlights of that was the fact that it did connect Green Meadows all the way down to Old Plank, because there were no sidewalks, and at that time we really didn't think that there would ever be sidewalks in the foreseeable future, because that is all developed commercial property. So this really does give the connectivity and pedestrians the ability, especially with an open campus, the students to be able to walk down that trail and go to some of the places along that road to get lunch and during those time periods. So I think this will certainly be good. I'm certainly not going to say that the school should have to build a sidewalk when we've got the trail there, and I think they're taking adequate precautions with the sidewalks. And I will certainly support this project.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I'm generally loath to approve sidewalk variances because we're in such desperate need of sidewalks in this city, and it's a tool that helps us build up that network. But if ever there was a good example, this was it, where we really have a sidewalk. It's just not immediately on the property. It's across one road. So with the two connections that exist and the third one that the school district's going to build, I really think that satisfies the requirement. And I will just end by saying I don't always like to make decisions based on an argument that we've sat there and observed and there's hardly any pedestrians, so. But if there's no facility to make it safe for pedestrians, you're probably not going to get many pedestrians. But nevertheless, I think this is a good compromise.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I think this wasn't an issue of pedestrian facilitation. This was an issue of access to an already existing trail, which has served that the purpose that Ms. Nauzer was suggesting for some period of time. So. It also provides access to one, to my favorite restaurant that has a Euros over there. So that's so I'm perfectly satisfied to approve this variance.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 5116, Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Please read B-5216.
Council Bill 5216 is an ordinance authorizing a contract for sale of real estate with Gates Real Estate, LLC for the acquisition of property in the Gates subdivision located near High Point Lane and Route K for land preservation and neighborhood park purposes, directing the city clerk to have the agreement recorded and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
Thank you, Mayor. We're requesting an acquisition to acquire two tracts of land in the Gates subdivision. With two parcels, one's 60.81 acres, the other one's just a little over 5 acres. It's a combination of purchase and donation for $360,000. It is funded by the 2010 park sales tax. We had two appraisals done. The first one we did back in 2015 by Moore and Shyrock, and then again in January in 2016 by the Home Evaluation Group. And you can see the pricing of those appraisals really makes a selling price of $360,000 represents a significant donation by a developer, Mr. Mike Tompkins. The 60.81 tract includes a dedicated right-of-way easement for the future expansion or improvement of High Point Lane. So the land is currently preserved for natural open space with possible areas for neighborhood park amenities and gardens. We became aware of this property in 2013 when the school was looking at this site for what became the Beulah Ralph Elementary School. And then since then, we've been kind of keeping our eye on it. And Mr. Tompkins came forward with some plans with for us to look at, and we were very happy to work with him on this. The tract does contain the Little Bonfim Creek and has, in our trails master plan, the Little Bonfim Trail is shown going through the corner of the tract. Which counts some of the scoring for this tract. Anytime we acquire land for preservation, for natural preservation, we utilize the scoring, the tool that's developed by our Natural Legacy Plan. The Greenbelt Land Trust is responsible for scoring properties for land preservation. They went and looked and scored at this. They look everything from at-risk species all the way down to what's the zoning. These two tracts scored 37 out of a points out of a possible of 65, and it ranked it in the top five of high priority land acquisition in terms of natural preservation. So we are pleased to present this as a possible site for acquisition. And so if you feel that you're okay with this, please approve the ordinance authorizing the city manager to sign the real estate purchase and sale agreement. Again, after this acquisition, we'll have a balance of about $940,000 for other council priorities. Questions?
Council, questions? Would anyone in the public like to speak? Seeing none, we'll move to council discussion.
I just did have a question. Just before you... just with respect to that $940,000 figure, that persists even. So this predated these considerations predated that fund balance essentially for both this piece of property and also that other piece of property that was on the east side of town.
Correct.
Thank you.
It's not very often that I get two things in the fifth ward that are actually not controversial.
You
so that's
usually
great.
Get more than that, right?
Well, I guess it depends. At least it's not electric transmission lines. But no, I think that this will be a much, it is a much needed amenity down in the fifth ward. I think the fact that it's going to be natural and more nature preservation, I think that's something the community has told us that they would like. With the last survey that we sent out to the public. And I would just like to say that I am very supportive of this, and I would like to keep it as natural and native as possible. I don't even know about putting in a neighborhood park, since there's a couple of little pocket parks, and the new Gates subdivision has some very fine amenities for their residents. And so I would like to keep this as natural as possible. So good acquisition. Yep.
Let me just say I appreciate the fact that you have an objective scoring mechanism for determining the value of land acquisition. It's very helpful to us. Any other comments?
Yeah, just a comment. I want to thank Mr. Tompkins for stepping forward with the proposal in the first place, and certainly with the donation of land. I take it, Ms. Nazar, you don't want any ball fields here. So I suspect this will be a part of our portfolio, if you will, of relatively natural spaces, and that seems to fit within the context of where we have been going with parks for a long time. So I appreciate all of that.
Please go ahead.
If I may. I also very much appreciate Mike Tompkins negotiating with us, and think that this acquisition is a good deal for the city and fills an important gap in our parks plan. I encourage you, as you develop it, to not that we're doing a lot of development, and I do agree that it should be left in a very natural state, but to make as many access points as possible. And I know Mike is planning with his final plat to create quite a number of public access easements connecting between the streets of the Gates subdivision and the public park area, which I think will be much appreciated by those residents, but also really encourage a healthy lifestyle in that part of Columbia.
I'm going to jump in and heap praises on this too. There's a lot of developmental pressures in that area. I think we got an incredible deal, and we get a lot of park for how much money. I do appreciate the donation. It is going to add value to the area, but it, and it fits with Mr. Tompkins' edible landscaping that's going on there. I think there is some developmental, you know, there's some flat kind of areas that could have some, you know, I like the idea of the community garden kind of approach that to tie in what else is happening. It's a really beautiful part of the area that it's been, you know, bittersweet to see develop. So it's nice to see a nice chunk of it preserved for all eternity. This is really, you know, the things that makes me proud to be on council, especially the great story about dying for lack of a second in 1989 and then paying, you know, eight times as much for something half as good 20 years later. People in the future are going to be thankful for our foresight and the voters for approving money for natural space acquisition.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 5216, Ms. Nowzer.
A very happy yes.
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
B-5316?
Council Bill 5316 is an ordinance approving the final plat of the Gates Park, a major subdivision, accepting the dedication of rights of way and easements, authorizing a performance contract, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff?
It's a request by Crockett Engineering on behalf of owner Mike Tompkins et al., and this approves a one-lot plat of approximately 56 acres. Would make a great park and natural preserve located west of High Point Lane. So this is really just creating one of the units of real estate. There is a portion of the park you just saw that's already platted. That's why it doesn't add up to 65 acres. But I'll try to answer any questions council may have.
Seeing no questions, are there any comments from the public? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Any council discussion? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 5316, Ms. Nowzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
I think next is B-5816, is that correct?
Council Bill 5816 is an ordinance appropriating funds to correct a funding shortfall in the sewer utility as it relates to the conversion of a boiler from fuel oil to natural gas and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
This project is to add the availability to burn natural gas to the backup heating system for the wastewater treatment facility. Originally funded as part of the FY15 supplemental budget, the process of getting a PO issued for this was delayed by ensuring we had compliance with current codes and insurance requirements for boilers. The PO for this project was finally issued in October of 2015, and by that time the budget had rolled and the supplementals funded for this project were not held. This project has gone forward using existing funds, and this appropriation request is needed to ensure we can finish the FY16 projects we have scheduled. So with that, to answer any questions about this project.
Yeah, I'm the one who asked to have this pulled because I just wondered where the money was coming from.
It's going to come out of the retained earnings for the sewer utility, which is where the funds from FY15 got rolled back into.
Okay.
So it's simply what happened was FY15, we didn't get the supplemental held, it rolled back in the retained earnings, and we're just appropriating it back out again.
Okay, thank you. I just couldn't figure out where it was coming from. So,
any other questions? Would anyone in the public like to speak? Any discussion by council? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 5816, Ms. Nowzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Please read the consent.
B-6116.
61, yes.
Council Bill 6116 is an ordinance amending Chapter 13 of the City Code as it relates to pawnbrokers and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
Yes, I'm going to start off and then I'm going to hand it over to the police department to explain the impact. This request came as a result of a council request from Councilman Trapp to make some changes to the pawnbroker ordinance. There are three changes really made by the proposed amendments that are on your agenda tonight with the eye toward looking at future changes as it relates to the definition of the types of entities to which the pawnbroker rules would apply and to which types of secondhand stores. But for tonight's purposes, the particular amendments in front of you focus on the record keeping. And while it looks, based upon the draft that's in your ordinance, that there are more than three changes being made, it appears that way because of some reformatting that took place when we were drafting the changes. Previously, Section 13-77 required, it was a, I call it a run-on sentence. It didn't use bullets as a means of identifying what information pawnbrokers had to keep when it came to a pawn transaction. So what we did was we took those and we broke them out into specific bullet points. And so there are now nine specific bullet points in the ordinance. They look like they're new. They're not new, with the exception of requirement number six that requires a description of the property purchased or received, which is deposited with the pawnbroker. Number nine requires, as part of the description of the person who is leaving goods for pawn, to take a photograph of the person who is leaving those goods if it is a cash transaction. So it's only required in the event of a cash transaction. The rationale for that is that if it is either a credit or a check transaction, there is the security that you're going to be able to track that individual at least through a secondary source other than whatever identification that they've produced on site. And I'll let the police department speak to the benefits of that photograph. The other issue is requiring pawnbrokers to use an electronic database as designated by the chief of police. I think currently the standard is Leeds Online, which is a statewide database already required. All pawn shops are required to use an electronic database by the state, so that's in conformance with state law. And then lastly, is a requirement in a new section 13-82, which would require a 7-day waiting period before an item that is taken in on pawn could be disposed of by the pawnbroker, thus allowing the police department an opportunity to take a look at Leeds Online and the database to determine if there's stolen property. So with that, those are the changes in the ordinance before you. I'm going to hand it over to Deputy Chief Schlute and Assistant Chief Hunter to explain the police rationale for those.
Essentially, the 7-day waiting period allows us to have that extra time to utilize our resources to better identify criminals that are using that as a marketplace for stolen goods. The identification, as far as taking the photograph, for us is essential. In everyone probably doesn't look like their photograph in a state ID, issued ID. So there are variances that we need to look at further, and specifically with the photograph and being up to date and looking for specific suspects and what their current images of them would be beneficial to us in our investigations. So those are some of the key components that we're looking at in helping us to identify the stolen property, have the time and the resources to do it, and to specifically identify the suspects that are moving these goods through a market. So
I have a few questions. I'm always uncomfortable with rules and regulations that stop at the city limits. So the first question I have is, what is the difference between our proposed ordinance and existing state statute? What are the differences? Because there are state statute that regulates this.
I couldn't honestly tell you. Okay, I don't know what the differences are.
There are not, in my view, there are not any significant differences. The state statute does require you to identify the individual who places goods for pawn and provide receipts. As a matter of fact, we probably have fewer regulations in many respects.
Well, I guess from one if there's already state law, why do we need to replicate it?
Well, as a city, you do have the ability to specify how you want the person's description to be ascertained. So you have the ability to add the requirement for a photograph if you so desire. You have the ability to provide for a waiting period before disposition of the property. So anything that is in conformance with the existing state regulations, the city has the ability to supplement.
Is a waiting period part of state statute?
No. There are waiting periods if an item has been determined to be, if there's a legal hold placed on those items. I think that's what it's called, isn't it? A legal hold or a hold. They can place a hold. What the police department has requested is the opportunity to determine whether or not they need to do that. If an item is either sold or destroyed very, very quickly, they don't have that opportunity. So they're just asking for a reasonable amount of time in which to review those records to determine and check them against the database to determine whether or not action needs to be taken.
I've lived a fairly sheltered life, so I need a little background on the pawn. I haven't watched the TV show Pawn Saws or whatever, but how much of here's the thing: if I'm going to steal something and I'm going to get my picture taken in Columbia, why wouldn't I just take it to Ashland and sell it in an Ashland pawn shop? I mean, it just seems as though that by perversely we can put in place a set of regulations that, in fact, will make it harder for you to trace stolen goods because, they're taking pictures of me here in Columbia. I'm going to go to Ashland where they don't take pictures.
I would say inversely, if we don't have good identification, it doesn't really do us any good. So we need to be able to identify that person when they come in the door. I'll tell you, it's come up, I can think of homicide investigations where this has been a very key component. Jewelry becomes a really big issue or gold, especially gold gets melted down. And so sometimes if we don't have that information, it's really hard, especially when you're talking about, to be very frank, we have a lot of burglaries in Columbia. And so when someone's gone for a week and they come home and find that they've got $20,000 worth of jewelry missing, they may have been gone on a 10-day cruise. And so we already have a problem when we don't have a hold period.
I grant that part makes a lot of sense to me, but it just, again, it just seems intuitive to me that if I know you're doing that, I'm going to take it to a fence, to another fence in another location that doesn't, which in fact will make it harder for you to recover the stolen goods.
Well, I'll tell you part of our rationale, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's going to work, but the burglary problem is very frustrating. And the amount that we have and the size of this city, it's going to take some really good real-time information and a little bit of luck to catch somebody in the act. And so what we're trying to do in the memo that goes with it and what Nancy mentioned kind of alludes to is we really want to branch this out. We don't want to just focus on pawn shops. Actually, to my knowledge, for the most part, they're very cooperative here. Where we are seeing it continue to be a problem, where we'd like to spread it to, is a lot of the other secondhand good retailers.
Well, see, that was my next line of questioning, is that we all are secondhand dealers.
Right.
And if you've ever sold a lawnmower or a soccer ball, you're a secondhand dealer. And we got an email from a music store who sells secondhand music equipment. I mean, your kid's in the band for 2 years and is not going to play the clarinet anymore, so it goes, you sell it. Sporting goods. We see that. And then we have eBay and other internet sites which allow that. I'm going to ask the council if it wouldn't be wise to think this over a little bit and to tighten it up. I just personally feel like that there's some loose ends to this. I understand the intent, and I think it's the intent is good, but does this work? What other communities have done? Does it make it harder for you to recoup stolen goods? So I just would like to see information on whether this works, because obviously we have state statutes. There are some differences between what we're doing in state statutes. I'd personally like to know what those differences are. And I'd like to know what the success of other programs, so that we can follow up on this and make this a better proposal. I think we can make this a better proposal if we do a little more study on it. I'm probably, after depending on what other council members say, going to ask to table it to get a little more information on this, get more input from pawn shop businesses and other retailers who do secondhand sales, to make sure that we're not coming up with some unintended consequences, one of which might be driving stolen good fencing operations outside the city limits of Columbia, where, in fact, it could theoretically be harder for you to trace information when it's sold in another site. But I'll defer to other questions until I consider making that motion to table. Any other questions from council?
Just a couple of questions. Heretofore, I take it that there has been no such requirement for any photographs to be taken, right? And we're just assuming that this is a relatively easy thing for folks to do, since cell phones contain cameras and so on and so forth. And heretofore, as well, there has never been a waiting period. And that's, I see that as, at least I get the impression that that's something that you would appreciate in terms of the ability to have a little bit more time. So those two, that is correct. I don't have any particular objection to tightening this up and taking a look at it, and I'm not sure that that tabling wouldn't be the best bet. I do think that it is an issue, though, however, and whether or not, I mean, we have the same issue when we were talking about the tobacco 21 thing and the vaping and so on and so forth. In that case, it was an attempt, and I think a relatively successful attempt, from my vantage point, to at least interrupt the chain between folks who could buy cigarettes or vaping materials and give them to or sell them to high school kids. So I broke that up, but you have a point about just the fences going someplace else and selling this. So that's my comment.
Other questions from council?
I have another question too. So I'm looking at some correspondence that says that the pawn shops already take customer state IDs. They already have video surveillance in all of their stores. They report to leads online. And they've only had 14 stolen goods recovered out of 6,000 transactions. So if somebody's got an individual's driver's license information already, I mean, so you've got a state-issued ID with a picture in a database with the state of Missouri and a surveillance, why is that not sufficient for identification? What makes somebody think that because I stand in front of this wall here and somebody takes a phone with their iPhone, they're going to get something different than the surveillance?
I think a lot of it is it's real time, right? So like in my driver's license picture, I have blonde hair. I'm probably skinnier too, but you know, and so it's that real time, you know, I have a beard, I don't have a beard, I cut my hair, I didn't cut my hair. It's kind of that, what do they look like right now? And frankly, it does go to what Mr. Scala said. It's just pictures are so easy nowadays. It's just such an easier method than it was probably back when the ordinance was enacted, that it's just a much more common piece of technology that we have available to us.
True, but just because it's there doesn't mean we have to utilize it to the full extent, because, you know, my position on cameras and such as that. But then, so the ultimate goal is to expand this. And so I'm hesitant to pass something now with the intent of expanding this further and giving an open door to the expansion when, I mean, are we going to get down to having people do this for garage sales? I mean,
no.
Is certainly a big, you know, purveyor of the exchange of secondhand goods. Mm-hmm. Do we go to used clothing stores, used furniture stores that may have tools? I mean, where does this end? And then I'm looking at your all's lack of resources, lack of officers. I mean, are we going to require all these other secondhand stores to go on to this Leeds Online? I mean, so we're providing all this information and data, but we're not going to have anybody to go and access all this information and data because it's going to just be endless with the number of secondhand stores here in our community and in the surrounding areas, like the mayor and others said, pushing that beyond the boundaries of Columbia. So has any thought gone into any of this?
Yeah, actually, we have one civilian investigator who's dedicated to this solely. Mm-hmm. So his entire job is to check leads online, correspond with all the pawn shops, investigate online, check social media, online sites for stolen goods. So this is his primary.
But we're talking about expanding to all secondhand stores, which in the Columbia, there's quite a few of secondhand stores.
And he's done a report that identified specifically which secondhand stores the stolen good market is more likely to be attributed to. So,
and we have looked at some ordinances in some other jurisdictions that tried to strike the balance that you're talking about. Perfect example, I went to a used clothing store here a couple weeks ago. I'd only been in there once before, and I was surprised to see that when I went in, I had to go ahead and put my driver's license in a little machine, and it took a picture of it, I'm assuming, and then I had to fill out a bunch of information on the keypad before they would even talk to me about selling anything. It printed me out a ticket. I had to verify that it was all true. And so that's great if that's their company policy. We're not really interested in somebody's sweater that they're selling to Plato's Closet. So we're trying to find that balance too. But I will say, just in the reports and things that we deal with, I would say primarily, as far as the expansion part, we're talking about sporting goods and your electronics type, the video game consoles especially, is the major issues that come up. And we do actually, I mean, we obviously don't have the staff to look at each one, but we do case specific. If we're looking for something in particular, we look on eBay. We serve subpoenas and warrants on eBay and Craigslist and things like that when it's relevant. But the information flows in and then we check everything that comes into us. It's more of the reverse. So if we get a burglary report, then he goes in and looks for those specific items to see if they've come up, which kind of goes back to, again, to the waiting period.
Waiting periods, I don't think I have a problem with that. But like I say, this photographing of people that are doing technically, I mean, by all accounts, legal transactions, I think the surveillance state is getting to the point where it's there's not going to be an end to it, so I'm trying to slow that pace down. But I'll listen to what others say, and I'm certainly conducive to putting this off for a while.
I have a few questions, but I'll save my comments for the comments section. Would the 7-day hold apply if someone pawned a saw on a Friday and then wanted to buy it back on a Monday? Would they have to wait until the following Friday? So if the person returned their item, because some people do use pawn shops for short-term loans.
No, it's a sale to a third party.
So, okay. Does every pawn shop have video surveillance?
I believe so. I can't speak to the quality of it, but I believe everyone has it.
Okay, and sometimes there can be difficulty in getting good static images from video.
I could get on a whole nother topic about video quality. There is an ordinance that requires video in certain businesses, but not the quality of. But yes, I believe it varies from store to store.
And is it both of your opinions as law enforcement officers and trained and specifically in solving crime that these ordinance changes would make it easier to pursue prosecutions, even up to the point of a homicide?
Yes.
Yes.
And is there any relationship between drug trade and pawning of stolen goods?
Absolutely.
And is there a big increase in heroin overdoses in Columbia?
Unfortunately, we have seen that as well, yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak?
Mayor, members of the council, I'm Tom Snyder. I'm a lawyer with offices at 11 North 7th Street here in Columbia, and I represent Midwest Gold and Gem Corporation. They do business here in Columbia's Family Pawn. They have three stores in other communities. They have two here, one on the Business Loop, one on Paris Road. It is a company that was founded by Don Mays over 30 years ago, and they have always cooperated with Boone County law enforcement, and I think that that would be acknowledged.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. They oppose the proposed ordinance for really five reasons. First, we believe it to be an unauthorized departure from state law. I don't want to get into a legal debate here tonight. This is not the right forum, but we don't think that it's permitted in the first place. Second of all, we think it's unnecessary. We don't see what is broken that needs to be fixed. Third, portions of it are personally intrusive. Fifth, it's discriminatory in that it covers only one small segment of the secondhand market, although I understand that that might be addressed later on in other ordinances. I appreciate that. I think that there are five departures from the state statute that I was able to determine on a cursory review, and I'll only reference three of them. One is the seven-day hold. That's not in state law, nor do we believe it is it authorized. There is also a provision in this ordinance and even in its existing form which prohibits the purchase and pawning of items which originally had a serial number which is no longer on the particular item, and it even includes things such as electric buffers. That's not in the state statute, nor do we believe it's authorized, but I think that the most difficult or the biggest objection is the photographing of the heads and shoulders of individuals who are involved in cash transactions. I mean, that we think is very intrusive and very much sends the wrong message to the potential customers of Family Pawn, virtually all of whom are hardworking, law-abiding folks. I mean, it's almost like a booking. It's without fingerprints, it seems to me. That was my first reaction when I saw that, and I think it's going to have a chilling effect on sales, and I think it's going to have a chilling effect on who will do business here in Columbia with the pawn shops. And the amount of traffic in stolen goods, at least at our pawn shop, is minimal. There were 15 or 14 incidents in 2015 out of over 6,000 transactions. I said incidents, I meant items, and that is an infinitesimal percentage. We don't think that the ordinance is going to work. We would follow up on the mayor's comments that it could very well be counterproductive. I mean, if someone is dealing in stolen goods and they have to be photographed here in Columbia, why wouldn't they go to Jefferson City? And, you know, we just don't think that the ordinance will be effective. There's Craigslist, there's eBay, there's sales on the streets, there's flea markets, and so on. So we don't think that this will address a substantial enough sector of the secondhand trade to justify it. Jordan Hargrove, who's the manager of the five stores, is here if you want to know more about the workings of pawn shops. But they do all the record keeping that's in the state statute now. There is a database which they participate in, and they cooperate with law enforcement upon request, and they always have. If you have any questions, be glad to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Eugene Elkin, 3406 Range Line. I just merely wanted to rethink maybe three-day holding pattern. If we got an item in question, the officers want to do fingerprints rather than picture taking. They issue the ID, as you all were saying. Maybe the person's changed, but the only thing of real importance is the last hand that touched the item. And that truly tells you who was there and who did the sale, thinking that they might get away with stealing. But I don't see any purpose for the picture, repeating of the picture taking, and it all depends on how much time staff has for doing fingerprints, too. So I just feel like we're going down the wrong road of sometimes said here, too many regulations.
Come forward. Name and address.
My name is Robert Hayes. I live at 100 North Keene Street here in Columbia. Been a resident here for 36 years, and I'll tell you, I represent one of those secondhand stores. I work at Army Gear, and quite frankly, in the 6 years that I have worked there, I cannot remember yet a single time when police officers have come to my shop to investigate a stolen property item. I have yet to see that ever happen. On the practical side of the new ordinance or on how that ordinance might be written, I have customers who bring in items that may fill four tubs. There could be five items, and there could be 150 items, stuff where ex-military members have gotten out. They have a lot of gear with them. They have uniforms. They have backpacks. They have stuff that could be considered sporting goods, outdoor gear, camping gear. It would be an unbelievable task to try to record those items and even initially get permission from them to take their photograph before the transaction even happens in the first place, because people already feel like they have a pretty severe invasion of privacy as it is, and that right there would probably cause us to lose sales, to lose business, to lose trust, and potentially lose sales tax from lost sales. And this business of Army Gear has been here in Columbia for at least, I think, 44 years. Maybe two or three times a year, we might get a phone call from a soldier who said, I've had a bunch of gear stolen out of my car. And we'll take down their name and their phone number and a description of what they're missing. And we kind of watch for it as it comes through the door. We keep that name and number right next to our cash register. And we have yet to ever identify anything that's been stolen coming through our doors. So, you know, based on the secondhand thrift stores, we're kind of like a secondhand store ourselves. I just don't see how this ordinance can help, although I do sympathize with the police department because Columbia has got, seems like, more burglaries than I've ever seen in my life. We've been here 36 years. It's not the same Columbia we used to live in. But I don't think this ordinance is going to help. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Jordan Hargrove, 107 Arbor Drive. As he said earlier, I actually manage most of the out-of-town pawn shops. But I just got a hold of this and started looking at it. And one of the biggest issues that I have right now is an unknown cost for us. Obviously, we would have to make equipment upgrades of some sort and software upgrades. Our software is not capable of doing this right now. And I don't know if that's a $1,000 thing per store or if that's a $50,000 thing per store. I really have no idea. So in the long run, I'd like to try to get a little bit more information on what this would require from us. I don't want to repeat anything that Mr. Schneider has already talked about, but the waiting period, I completely understand. I've been lived in this town my whole life. I was a police officer here for a long time, over 9 years. I taught at the police academy, so I really do understand what they're begging for here. And I think it could help. I'd like to know how much. If we had a six-month period where we could communicate with them and see how many times did they talk to us after we had already sold something that was considered stolen. Does it happen once a year, 100 times a year? Just going off of memory, it seems like something that does not happen very often. Maybe 3 times a year, and that's me trying to think of 5 stores. So that's all I just wanted to add is the cost. I really don't know.
Yes, can ma'am. Can you ask a couple questions for me?
I can try.
Can you explain to me what exactly goes into Leads Online? And so an individual comes in and you take down all their information off the driver's license, which would have personal information, name, address, driver's license. Years ago, they had social security numbers as driver's licenses. How is that information protected for the consumer, that information doesn't get out? And again, how do you report to leads online, and what information do you take that goes into that database?
Almost everything that's on the driver's license we take. Mm-hmm. So there's not socials anymore, so we take driver's license numbers. We also have descriptions. We will, you know, if you look at someone and they don't look like they're 5'11", 180 pounds anymore, so we will ask sometimes, but you know, that can get tense on asking people those questions. And then all that is submitted nightly as part of our computer program that we wrote. So it's all submitted in an encrypted file that is sent to Leeds Online from every store every single night. And then we get a confirmation that it did upload. We have had problems with that every once in a while, maybe once every 4 years. And usually one of the police departments that we report to will go, hey, we didn't get your file last night. And then we'll fix it within a few minutes.
So it's a description of the item, maybe a serial number if there's something on it?
Yeah, so you'll have make, model, serial number, description, and if there's any notes. Sometimes if we need to add something else, like a color or things like that. And all that will get submitted, and then who we got it from. And all their information gets submitted along with who we are, so where it went.
So if you had to take a picture of every customer that came in, how would you be able to protect that information of those photos, and where would, I mean, just tell me the burden you would find if you had as far as storage.
Sure. So right now we don't have that kind of storage capability because, I mean, I think in each of our stores has around 30 to 50,000 clients in our database because with firearms records, we have to keep that for a very long time. So, and then at any given time, we have over 50,000 items in the store. So you are talking about, I would assume, large quantities of data. So that would kind of be our upgrade. Now, as far as keeping it safe, I don't think that would be an issue. We have, you know, we do everything we can to protect our databases and the amount of information that we have. I don't know how the software would work that we'd have to upload, and I don't think you'd send in pictures because they don't want pictures on Leeds Online.
Because you would have.
But I don't know that for sure. I don't know.
Because I'm assuming you'd have to have some way to cross-reference the individual who was involved with the transaction with the item that they were pawning.
Yeah, I'm going to guess to really make it uphold, you'd almost have to have a picture of them with the item so that later on they couldn't argue that, no, I sold something else earlier. That wasn't me.
So this could be a logistical issue, very big logistical issue.
Sure, and it could be something that was manageable, but I honestly don't know without really spending time looking into it, okay. Which I'm happy to do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
My name's John Clark. I live at 403 North 9th Street. And actually, there are a fair number of burglaries on my street over a period of time, as there are in lots of places in Columbia. And actually, I didn't think about this, but is Mr. Tapp, is it true that when you had proposed this that you had not actually talked to many of the secondhand shops or the pawnbrokers and so forth?
No, I haven't, Mr. Clark.
And I must admit, it makes sense to me that as a way of reducing the disastrous effects of serious substance abuse, addiction, and abuse, that one of the ways is somehow or another to reduce the availability of the money to buy the drugs. But at the same time, so I think that's a decent goal. I don't know whether that's been shown to be an effective strategy any place in the country, but I think the goal of reducing that makes sense. But the idea of developing this, frankly, without real getting together with stakeholders, talking to them about what they're doing, what they're not doing, and also some kind of indication about whether, frankly, dealing with these legal businesses has actually been shown any place to significantly reduce the availability of money, as opposed to fences or other places or, as you say, on Craigslist. So my sense is that real desirability of reducing opioid and other serious drug abuse is really valid. And, of course, it takes money to buy that. But I just really can't see this as a sufficiently well-developed approach. Frankly, it would involve the various business stakeholders, and actually the police would be involved in that, because this is an enormous amount of effort, and I don't see any actual link that's data-driven that said this would actually limit the amount of money. There may be other ways, but I don't see. This is the kind of thing where it really needed this much broader-based input. And there may be things that came out of that that would be workable, but I don't see it in this ordinance at this time. So I think it needs more work with more input from real stakeholders about this. And maybe actually people who've been buying and selling and drugs and to really help track down these other channels by which they get money. Thank you.
Anyone else? We'll go to council discussion.
Can I ask a couple of quick questions, Mayor?
Yeah.
Would the civilian investigator be the point of contact for secondhand stores in regards to stolen goods? And who is that?
Jeff Adams.
And what, Jeff, I'm sorry?
Adams.
Adams. And how can he be reached?
I can send you his phone number, his desk.
Super. Thank you.
And his email.
Super. Okay.
I'll start by saying that I agree 100% with Mr. Clark. May I leave office now?
about this issue in particular, right?
Seriously, I do believe I agree with Mr. Clark's analysis. I think it's very well put together. I think this is very well intentioned, but I don't think we've considered all the permutations of this, and I think there needs to be interaction with the stakeholders, because I'm just averse to putting in a regulatory environment which can be sidestepped by driving 10 miles. And again, I see that as actually making the job of CPD harder because, you know, why am I going to sell something in Columbia? You know, I'm going to sell another jurisdiction where it can't be traced. So I'm going to move to table this for till the first meeting in June, and to allow staff to interact with the stakeholders. I'm also interested. It's really not clear to me how our proposal differs from existing state regulations at this point. And I think we deserve to have that clarified. I think the intentions are good, and I think it may have a lot of possibilities, but I think it needs a lot of work. So I'm going to move to table this to the first meeting in June.
And I'll second that.
Discussion on the motion to table. You can also talk about it.
Yeah. I would agree with the mayor about 75% here. That's pretty good. But for some of the same reasons, and some are a little bit differently. I don't have any particular problem with a regulatory environment if it's well thought out. I just think that there are lots of questions that people have raised. I'm more satisfied with what legal has told us in terms of being a little bit more restrictive than state statute. I think that's probably legitimate or a reasonable opinion. But I am a little uncomfortable with some of the questions that were raised, not only the intrusion with another picture and so on, and how that might affect the business climate and so on. But I think, if we take a little bit more time to look into some of these questions, and certainly the police department now has the information with respect to a lot of these questions, and so does the rest of the council and the staff, we could probably come up with at least a better proposal that we can deal with in a more comprehensive way. So I think that's a reasonable approach.
I'd just like to say something, too. I would like to say I commend Mr. Trapp. I can certainly say his heart is in the right place. Drugs are a horrible scourge in our society. My son's best friend died of a heroin overdose a little over a year ago. And I've known other people who have had children who have died from heroin overdose. So this is certainly something that has touched our family and friends. And unfortunately, the people that I have known that have overdosed on such drugs had easy access to money, but were not out stealing goods to feed their habits. But this is a problem we have to face as a society. But I think some of the concerns that have been brought forward on this proposal need to be worked out. And I really want, as we move forward, I would like to see data-driven solutions that are based in reality and see what other people have done. I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel on this. I think we should look at what other best practices are and other communities are doing. I think this is a multifaceted problem. It's going to take numerous solutions to deal with, you know, the theft of goods and the, you know, the supply that gives to people who are engaging in illicit drug use. So I certainly support moving this to June and hope that we will be able to come to something that will begin to address this issue.
And also, I wanted to say that in terms of generating data-driven information that will inform our decision, that it's important to make sure that we're not unfairly victimizing hardworking, innocent people who are simply trying to make ends meet, and also those secondhand shop owners who really see very little of, if any, stolen goods. It seems to me, from what I'm hearing, is that we have regulations in place that may actually prove to be sufficient for the problems that we're facing. So as we're going forward, I would certainly endorse waiting, getting more information, finding out what the state statutes are to make sure that we are not contradicting anything that we shouldn't be. So I would agree with the mayor and everybody else.
Sure. So I certainly feel some sense of urgency of trying to move something forward, and I push this forward. Often the public hearing is kind of what draws people out, and to where, you know, I've certainly something that I've been talking about for a long time and have both in council comments and media and people. And so I didn't expect that we would move forward on this tonight, because certainly at 11 minutes before our meeting started is the first that that I heard from the pawn shop industry. So I don't see anything wrong with taking in stakeholder input and working towards something that's going to be a solution. But I do think that we should do more. And if other communities, sometimes it's important to lead as a locality, and that's why we are a charter city, so that we have the opportunity to experiment. And I think we should show support for our law enforcement if we're going to, as a community, decide that we're going to have less police officers than is standard in communities our size, that we should look for every possible public policy angle to support their work and facilitate the solving of crime. We're talking about things like homicide and heroin overdose, and those are very large harms that have to be weighed against the infinitesimal harm to a lot of folks about needlessly having a picture taken as they stand in video surveillance that's also held and reviewed for the police. So I appreciate, you know, some of the unanswered questions. I think this is a process, but played out largely how I expected it to, that we have this here. I think tabling it is appropriate, and I hope we can have this vigorous public discussion about how we can do this. This is really only phase one deals just with pawn shops. So when where there will be a report generated that will look at how can we narrowly tailor something that captures the secondhand retailers that are trafficking in stolen goods. Certainly we heard the attorney from the pawn shop say that 14 times in the last year they accepted stolen goods. That's a problem, you know, and if we don't have the tools to where we're only capturing some fraction of that their actual result, I mean, that's worth addressing. So I seconded the tabling motion. I think that's fine. I do always weigh my desire towards action with making sure that we have thoughtful public policy and that we listen to stakeholder feedback. But I hope that feedback is generated towards how can we work together to make our community safer? How can we protect our citizens from burglary, which continues to rise, and they are very difficult to solve. And a small group of burglars can really rise to that situation. So I appreciate the concerns that were raised, but I also think I remember the arguments when we discussed the armored personnel carrier, and the general consensus of council was that if the police are the experts on these things. If they say they need one, then they need one. And so I think that method of analysis is worth evaluating, that if our the two people who know the most in this room about how to solve crimes tell us that this ordinance is going to be helpful, I think we ought to listen.
We will consult with our benchmark cities group and see what the ordinances look like across that group, if that would be helpful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That'd be very helpful. The motion to table to the first meeting in June and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Please read the consent agenda bills.
Items on the consent agenda include bills 5016, 5416, 5616, 5716, 5916, 6016, and resolutions 2916, 3016, 3116, and 3216.
Please call the roll.
Bills 5016, 5416, 5616, 5716, 5916, 6016, and resolutions 2916, 3016, 3116, 3216. Ms. Nauzer.
Yes, on all bills and resolutions except R-3116, of which I abstain.
Ms. Peters.
Yes.
Mr. McDavid.
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin.
Yes.
Mr. Trapp.
Yes.
Mr. Scala.
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Mr. Thomas.
Yes.
We'll move to new business. Please read R-2816.
Council Bill 2816 is a resolution setting a public hearing on the voluntary annexation of property located on the southwest corner of Brown School Road and Rangeline Road, Highway 763.
Staff?
This action just sets a public hearing for your next meeting, so we would normally leave this on consent. However, there is an error in the description of the property. Instead of Rangeline Road, it should read Rangeline Street, because we do have a Rangeline Road, and that's Route Z, 6 miles to the east. It's the next range to the east, so next range line. So there's an amendment sheet that's been prepared that changes the description to Rangeline Street, also known as Route 763, and that is correctly identified in the ordinance.
May I have a motion second to amend R-2816 for the amendment sheet?
So moved.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Any questions from council? Would anyone of the public like to speak?
I'll just go ahead and read that.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 2816 as amended. Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Please read R-33-16.
Council Bill 3316 is a resolution authorizing the temporary closure of a portion of the sidewalk and traffic shifting and reduction of a vehicular lane width on Locust Street between 9th Street and 10th Street. The temporary closure of a portion of the sidewalk and vehicular lane on 10th Street between Locust Street and the alley. The temporary closure of the alley between Locust Street and Cherry Street, and providing covered protected sidewalk access on a portion of the sidewalk on 9th Street between Locust Street and the alley to facilitate the construction of a mixed-use building.
Staff, please.
Yes, thank you. Field Holding LLC will be demolishing two structures on South 9th Street and one structure on South 10th Street to construct a new multi-story, multi-use building. They have requested long-term street and or sidewalk closures on portions of South 9th Street, South 10th Street, Locust Street, and the alley between Locust and Cherry Streets for the period April 1st, 2016 through August 20th, 2017. Staff has issued the contractor a 30-day closure, which began on March 14th last week. That was to facilitate some of the movement of items out of the historic property. Parking meters will be reserved along the east side of South 9th Street, north and south sides of Locust Street, and east and west of South 10th Street. Lost parking meter revenues will be offset by the lease of the meter bags during the closure. Engineering Surveys and Services have contacted the adjacent property owners, informing them of the closures. Fields Holding LLC will be responsible for all signs and barricades necessary for the protection, safety, and convenience of the general public, and responsible for the repair of the streets and sidewalks due to any damage caused by the demolition and construction activities. Fielding Holding LLC will also be responsible for notifications to the media and emergency personnel. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, please.
I guess I had a question. I pulled this off the consent agenda because I thought for a number of reasons. One is I thought I might offer the public an opportunity to speak about this issue. It's obviously high on the priority list of public concerns, although we went through the legal process and so on. The question I had really had to do with any discovery or illumination about the staff's any perturbations or anything unusual about the staff's discussion with Fields Holding with respect to their future plans, and if anyone is starting to think in terms of any kinds of development agreements. I mean, I know we haven't seen any of the conceptual plans, and I assume the staff hasn't either. For this, and I just wanted to know where we were and what was taking place within the context of staff discussions with this group.
I'll respond. Fields Holdings has applied for several permits, demolition permits for the James Apartments building on 10th, and the buildings that house the Bridges Clothing Store and the Quinton's Bar and Grill. Buildings on 9th. They've also applied for land disturbance, which would be grading of the site and preparation of the site for a building. And then this month they've applied for a footing and foundation permit. We do not have full building plans, though, as of this moment. The only description of the building we have is from the developer himself, saying he intends to do a 10-story mixed-use building, two levels of parking, eight levels of apartments, and commercial storefront space on 9th Street. And there is a plan sheet that illustrates how they're proposing to lay out the ground level, so we know that much. And the site development permit indicates where the utility connections are proposed to be made. The sewer is on Locust, for example, so they propose to connect to an existing 8-inch line there, water down 9th Street. There is an off-site storm sewer indicated that would run all the way down to the new work that's the city is scheduling on Elm Street, so they will upgrade storm sewer, and this would be the connection from the roof drains of the new building to public storm drain. We have not discussed a development agreement. The sewer utility is evaluating the data on the building that was furnished directly to the sewer utility, so they're running calculations, and they will advise if the 8-inch main system is adequate. That runs to the west down to 7th Street as an 8-inch main, and then it joins a parallel line that runs actually in the alley on the north side of this property. And then at 6th Street, that system connects to one of the branches of the Flat Branch Phase 3 project where sewer main is being upgraded. So there's a substantial increase in available capacity at that location. So I can't say for certain that the sewer is approved, but we do know what the proposal consists of, and we're just awaiting the sewer utilities evaluation on that.
Do we have any timeline or a kind of expected timeline, ballpark figure for the evaluation and so on? And will it?
I believe the engineer for the developer has communicated to my staff that that's expected by the end of this month, that evaluation be
and,
done.
And that probably will predate any view that your department has of the plans of the building, I take it? I mean, that has not yet been submitted.
Yeah, I mean, if building plans come in, there'll be at least a two-week review, probably a little more considering the complexity of high-rise right. plans. But normally we get comments out in 10 working days once a complete submittal is in place.
But you don't know, but that probably will happen after the evaluation of the capacity.
It looks that way since into the last 10 days of March, and I don't know what the ETA is on building plans arriving for review.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll open this up to the public. I remind the public this is a bill allowing for sidewalk and street closures on a temporary basis.
Mr. Mayor, members of the City Council, my name is Dave Bennett. I'm with Engineering Surveys and Services, 1113 Fay Street. We are the civil engineers on this project. I don't really have a whole lot to add. I think the staff described the project very, very well. We're just moving on in the interest of public health and safety to extend this lane closure plan to a long term so we can cover the time we'll be in construction. And obviously, we will assure you that, you know, the connections for sewer, these types of things will all have to be in place or the project will not be able to go forward. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you. Clark? Now, you know, we could have left in total agreement.
Left it at 100%.
Well, actually, you're a complex guy. I'm a complex guy. I expect, probably I have expected, we would be in agreement more often than maybe we've had. But that's because we don't really kind of know each other very well. So I don't find this to be a huge surprise that we in agreement on something. I doubt it will be on this.
Give your name and address, Mr. Clark.
No, we can agree.
Don Clark, 403 North 9th Street. I was just listening to this talk about first the sidewalks and then the foot and foundation permit. There's an aspect of this that reminds me of part of the city process that I find just disastrous, which is this piecemeal, serial, one step at a time, as though we all don't know the whole process kind of thing. I think that's been a disaster for us generally. Of course, you've all received a memo from me, and I assume you may have read it. I actually believe much more is at stake. But the reason why it's apropos to talk about this tonight is precisely because of this piecemeal, step-by-step, and at the end, you really can't do anything about approach at the city. I find, and do not believe, that there is any way that the city staff can find justification, certainly for issuing an occupancy permit at the end of all this, but probably it'd be wise to warn people about a building permit. And I'm not thinking about foot foundations and footings. There is such a disastrous level of sewer backups, manhole cover backups, stormwater in basements, stormwater in backyards, stormwater in city. In the Flat Branch area, there is all the evidence of a real threat to the health and safety of the citizens in this area. And of course, if you add 400 more rooms, 400 more toilets, 400 more garbage disposals, 400 more water, that's just going to put more sewage into it, when in fact we cannot control at this time the stormwater that gets into the system and backs us up. I think it is very appropriate at this very time, at this beginning thing, for the council to direct staff to find that there is an insufficiency of the combined sanitary sewer stormwater infrastructure capacity, given this I&I thing, to warrant saying we don't have the capacity. We might issue you these piecemeal permits, but the fact is that we don't advise that you apply for them and get them. We certainly will not issue you an occupancy permit until those conditions, those actual threats on the ground of disease, all this kind of mold in people's houses, have ceased to exist. And I'm asking the council to basically direct the staff in that direction right now, tonight, or as soon as possible. You know that I believe you have the power and the authority, and I believe it is the principal responsibility of the city to protect the health and safety of citizens. And I don't think we've been doing it for a while, but that doesn't mean we can't start to do it. This doesn't mean endless delays. It just means we have to get on it and get cracking and fix this, and then we can go on with business.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the 25. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
Anyone else? I will start by saying that we were asked to allow sidewalk and street closures for public safety. That's what this issue is all about. It will be up to staff to determine if the plans conform to codes, ordinances, zoning. it'll be up to staff to determine if there are sufficient sewer electricity streets to service this. You know, this is a part of town. Is it historic or not? Well, you know, it's nostalgic to me because I remember the stores that were on 9th Street at Locust. Remember the Wabash, was it Wabash bus station that was on there? Yeah, we all remember that from the old Greyhound. Yeah. And, you know, I have an acquaintance who's, I think, well-known in the community who told me last night that he was, in fact, conceived in the James apartments. So
whoa.
I guess, you know, a nostalgia, historic, it's in the eye of the beholder. I regret to see that structure go. I regret to see the structures on 9th Street go, but this is an issue that will be determined by statute, ordinance, law, and that I will support in the for the benefit of public safety the proposed sidewalk and street closures.
Let me just make a few comments. I will support the street closure request as well, but I see this as a little bit broader in the context. I mean, it's no secret that I actually voted against the platting, which I suppose was risky on my part. Maybe not in the context of what the rest of the city council was doing, but I did so on behalf of representing some of the folks in my constituents who are very concerned about this, not only just the historical aspects of this. By the way, CC Steakhouse used to be in that corner too, and then it turned into McKenzie's. So I spent I actually took a bus from that Greyhound station one time to Champaign Urbanus, but that's not the issue. The issue that I have, and in concert, kind of what Mr. Clark was suggesting, were these issues about health, safety, and welfare, and how they trump some of these other traps they're legal traps. We fall into them. We have to comply with them. We have ministerial actions and all that kind of thing. And it starts the timing issues and everything else. That is important, this whole thing about these are unanticipated consequences of having high-density downtown student residential that has unique influence on the capacities of our infrastructure, particularly when it relates to sewage, sometimes with electricity. We even had a while back, not to revisit a painful moment, but this whole thing about a moratorium when this first started to be exploited. So the way to get at this, I think, has to do with this justification for the health, welfare, and safety. And what bothers me a little bit is I'm anxiously awaiting this evaluation in terms of the sewer capacity and so on, because I think that's a critical issue because of these unique this unique influence that these kinds of things have on the downtown area. But it does seem a little bit out of order because, I mean, we have no idea really what's coming other than the fact that we can project what we think is coming on the basis of what the impact of this this additional sewer capacity is going to need. And what really irritates me is how we tend to cobble things together to displace folks that are on the waiting list for some sewer relief, if you will, from some real health, safety, and welfare issues. And it doesn't speak well for those kinds of shifting priorities. That was the only reason that I pulled this off, really, was to give the public an opportunity to either vent or bring something new. It's not that I oppose the closure of the streets and sidewalks. This is going to move ahead. That was the will of the council. They're doing what they have to do, and I expect the staff will be good stewards of what it is that they have to do, and folks will meet the letter of the law. But frankly, I'm just a little bit dispirited about the spirit of the law, not just about the letter of the law. And I don't think I'm alone. So appreciate you willing to listen to me and my increased capacity to vent on this particular issue. But I'm willing to support this this closure request.
Any other comments? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 3316, Ms. Nowzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Please read the introduction and first reading bills.
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bills 6216, 6316, 6416, 6516, 6616, 6716, 6816, 6816, 7016, 7116, 7216, 7216, 7316, 7416, 7516, 7616, 7716, 7716, and 7816. First reading.
We'll go to reports. The first report is 2216, which is... The staff is offering an administrative public improvement, and the criteria is $50,000. Is that right? It has to be under $50,000.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, there's two reports on here, basically requesting or saying that these are eligible to go through the administrative public improvement process, and that's what we intend to do, unless you tell us otherwise.
So one is the grindstone stream stabilization. The other is the tree planter, downtown tree planter. Yeah. Any questions from council? Thank you. The next report is a letter from the Downtown Leadership Council with some questions about infrastructure development, sufficiency of services. And the staff have any comments?
No.
I think the I appreciate the work the Downtown Leadership Council has put on. I have not agreed with them on several issues, but I appreciate the work they've done. I think they point out some issues, though, that concern a lot of people in Columbia, and that is, you know, do we have sufficient infrastructure? And I guess I'm going to make a comment from my perch, in that everything that we do does have a sufficiency of services analysis. And I take back, and I think some members of the public may not be aware of this, but was it 4 years ago that a proposal came into town for a 25-story high-rise apartment complex at the current Bengals site?
That's right.
And the city manager clearly said, we do not have either the sewer capacity or the electric capacity at that point. And so basically he deemed insufficient services, and that project never really got to the council. And I'm not sure it really became public. It may have been in the newspaper, but there was really no formal presentation. And then I remind the public that we had a rezoning. It was either a year ago or 2 years ago for a 1,000-bed student apartment complex at the junction of 63.
Cinnamon Hill.
Yeah, 63 and basically 63 and Stadium Boulevard. Yeah. I voted against that because I didn't think adding 1,000 student commuters was that we had the adequate infrastructure and parking for that. So that was a sufficiency of services determination that I think we agreed on. I don't know what the vote was on that. It may have been 5-2. But again, it is a complicated issue. Either sufficient services exist or they don't. It's not a political question. It is a factual question. And I understand where they're coming from is how do they, what are the numbers, you know. I do understand, though, that we are reaching max on electric capacity downtown. Is that correct?
We're getting close to it again. I should, I guess, comment on a few things. We do a professional looks at every plan that comes in, and every plan is a case-by-case basis. So depending on the use of the property, it will either use more or less sewer or electric or water, and need more stormwater service. So every project's analyzed for its own merits and its own impact on the system, whatever system we're looking at, and we look at all of them. And so the professional staff, I remind folks, these are
professionals. They've devoted their life to it. They have advanced degrees in it, engineers largely, or in every case. And they put their credentials on the line every time they stamp something's okay. So as you remember well, it was a painful experience. We said no a few years ago because we were out of electricity and we were pretty uncertain about the sewer situation. Well, not uncertain. We were worried about the sewer situation. So we ended up making lists with green lights and red lights about which projects could happen and which couldn't, and really the ones that you ended up approving had a lower impact than the ones that you didn't approve, like the 24-story building that didn't get to your table. So as time progressed, council fixed those two problems. You funded the Flat Branch Relief Sewer projects, two of the four phases. Two of the projects went together to pay for a third of those phases, so we've got three out of the four phases. And as you remember, that replaces a 100-year-old brick sewer, so everybody's really benefiting from that piece, that replacement. But it also provides capacity. So for future use decisions or developments, it does provide capacity. The other electric piece is we have a line from Rebel Hill downtown, which creates more capacity for electricity, and that's what's enabled all the projects that were in the pipeline at that point to proceed and complete. There's still a little bit left, and we take each project as it comes in, and we do some detailed analysis, and we keep a running total of what's left. It's a complicated system, as you know, you're remembering from the transmission line debate about substations and how much load they can bear and where we can switch that load. And so there's a lot of choices we can make on the ground about circuits and where that electric load is served. So all that said, our fundamental role as staff is to apply the law that the previous councils have passed, and our discretion ends at yes or no. Does it meet it or does it not? And then if a developer feels like they have a compelling argument to make to change our mind, we bring it to you, and you have the unenviable task of deciding if it is a compelling argument or not. In many cases, we will negotiate. If it's a particularly big problem, we'll negotiate a development agreement. And investors will agree to those terms if they feel like it's worth it. Sometimes they don't. There are negotiations we have that don't even get to this table because they say, okay, it's too much of a lift financially, and they don't complete the project. So all that said, there is still capacity left in electric. It's a lot less than the sewer side of it, but the real benefit of the sewer project is everybody that's already here. Those are the real beneficiaries. And so, but it does allow capacity for future changes in how we use the land. We're getting close to the finish line on the changes to our zoning ordinances, combining the subdivision code with the zoning code. Largely excellent work. I think there's some parts that some constituents disagree on still, so we're allowing plenty of time to hash out those differences. That'll be a big change, and how we move forward will be set with those new rules once you approve them. And then our job as staff doesn't change. We just have a new rule book to apply to the proposals that come forward. So I hope that's somewhat helpful about
it. Any comments or questions from council?
Just a few comments. This is kind of related to what I was suggesting before, too. I probably have a slightly friendlier inclination towards the DLC. I think they do great work, as you alluded to as well. But they do tend to bring up these issues, particularly when it comes to sufficiency of services. And I guess, and I'm not questioning the professional staff. I trust the professional staff to do that. They do yeoman's work, and they always have. And that's not the issue here. It's really a question of whether or not there is something inherent in the process, and that's our position as policymakers to determine how this process plays out. You know, I'm reminded of that 25-story building, and I think it never really did hit our desk formally, but it was reported in the newspaper. And then as a reaction to that, I think that was the initiative to take a look at what we possibly could do legally to make sure there was at least another step to jump through, and that was resulted in the C2 interim. And it wasn't that folks couldn't build anything over 10 stories. They could, but they went through a more scrutiny, if you will, to do that kind of thing. And you're seeing what's happened as a result of that. They're building 10-story buildings, so they don't have to go through that kind of scrutiny, which is perfectly legitimate. That's within the purview of C2, even the interim C2 law that was passed. But we get a tremendous amount of criticism. I don't know. I wish I had a dollar every time I heard the business from someone or another saying, well, you moved the goalposts. You know, well, it was legitimate. We moved the goalposts because we were worried about the health, safety, and welfare of the community. That's one of the reasons why, I wouldn't characterize it as moving the goalpost. I'd characterize it as being prudent and making sure that we were protecting those issues. So I have said it a number of times. It's probably worth saying again, and that is growth has tremendous benefits, no question about it. It also has tremendous costs. And although we have the capacity now with the Flat Branch a relief sewer system, more capacity. The fact of the matter is that then the public gets outraged at the amount of green space that we take down in order to bury these sewers in the middle of a 45-foot wide path that has this capacity, all for the benefit of someone who is densely housing students to the extent. I mean, I'm not saying that student housing was not necessary downtown. I voted for one of those proposals, the original one. It's the balance and the extent to which this kind of capacity affects other people downstream. And that's the balance I'm trying to strike here. And it's a balance that's based on health, safety, and welfare, which not only deals with some of the folks' sewer issues that have not been that have been languishing, but also the health, safety, and welfare in terms of the aesthetic sense that we have in this community. I mean, you can't put these big relief sewers everywhere. You won't have any trail left after a while. We just have to make those kinds of decisions. And I'm looking forward to the debates and getting this unified zoning code and getting things in place, because this kind of reminds me of dealing with a tree ordinance, for example. When it appears that there's going to be change in the tree ordinance, all of a sudden everybody harvests timber. I mean, and that's kind of what's happening, I think, in the downtown area. At any rate, enough of that. I appreciate that the Downtown Leadership Council continues to bring some of these issues up. I think it's on a lot of folks' minds. Certainly in my ward, I hear about it all the time in terms of this balance and what's left for the adults downtown and so on. And I'm not trying to be flippant. We do have needs for the students, no question about it, and people do have a right to build within the context of their own zoning in the C2 or under this interim C2 zoning. But we have to be a little bit sensitive to this and provide some balance.
I also appreciate the Downtown Leadership Council's letter raising some important questions, and I want to make two responses. One is, I think the information about capacity should be more transparently available to us as the council and to the public and to the Downtown Leadership Council and everybody else. Clearly staff know, have some kind of formulas and calculations to determine in any given case Well, we ought to be able to know how much capacity is left in any major sewer and how many more toilets can be hooked up to it before it needs to be expanded. Now, it's always more complicated than you would like it to be, and that we have wet weather and dry weather situations that make a difference. But I think having more clarity about that from the engineers would be helpful in making decisions about sewer electricity, roads. I thought that was a great example, Bob, and anything else. The second point is that we should have more transparency and clarity about how the new infrastructure is paid for. And it's pretty clear to me from my analysis that in most of these utilities and infrastructure systems, the majority of the cost of expansion is paid for from existing rates and taxes and not charged in development fees. The development fees that do exist are too small, although the sewer fee is approaching a more equitable position. If we just had more clarity about all of these issues, then we could have a proper debate and allocate costs in a fair way, and I think we would really get over a lot of the challenges we're having with growth and development.
We'll move to comments by the public. That's right. We have one more report. That's the transfer of funds report. It's informational. Other questions from council?
Yeah, I had a quick question. What is the Moores Lake Restoration Project?
This is the lake behind the electric plant where we burn coal. It's really sort of an ash pond. And so this is the effort to clean that. And,
okay, sort of an environmental project.
Cleanup, that's what it is.
Got it. Thanks.
I'll yield 3 minutes to anyone from the public who wants to speak about anything.
My name is Gail Plemons, 17 Aldea. Development costs, development taxes never pay for the infrastructure. I think this is a health and safety issue. People in my neighborhood have for years and continue to have sanitary sewer backups in our basement, and we call the city and we get very little help. And I just think that we keep hearing that there's nothing you can do, nothing we can do because of the zoning laws. Well, people do not accept that anymore. That is just not acceptable. There's got to be something you can do. I realized that several years ago that the voters declined raising some development fees, but there has to be a way that you can look at the realistic fees that the development puts this strain on our infrastructure. And I just urge you to not give up, that there's nothing that we can do. That is just for those of us who have the problems in our neighborhoods, I realize that it's a big problem. I realize that there's ancient infrastructure. But when we see the problems in our neighborhood with flooding and sewer, and we see development continuing to go forward in our watershed, it just really makes us depressed. Thank you.
John Clark, 403 North 9th Street. Folks, you measure sufficiency of resources. Actually, the fact and some of the things that we see in the city with this doesn't suggest to me that our staff knows what they're doing. They're pretty good at some things, but this kind of thing, they use their own minds. You didn't ever give them any guidance on how to set up these standards. The standard for stormwater is, if that thing over there doesn't, once you build a building, doesn't put any more stormwater off than it was before, then it must be adequate capacity. Perfect example is, we'll get all this stuff and we'll put it in a pipe and we'll get that stormwater from our place right over here to a new trunk. Actually, that happened in one of the Odal projects. I'm sorry. The fact is, they had all those extra toilets and so forth that dumped into the sanitary sewer, and the stormwater from other places got into the sanitary sewer and backed up in people's basements. We have an unsafe condition as long as that I&I is not fixed. Mr. Mathis carefully did not mention, I'm sorry, the staff told you all, the relief sewers will not solve or reduce one thing about the sewer backups, the man overblows it. It is a dry weather thing at best. You measure at peak, and in this case, the peak has to be in storm events. And in storm events, the water going down to the wastewater treatment plant can go up 3 or 4 times. And the things that I gave, I'm sorry, if the staff is still stuck on what comes off before and after as the standard, it is an inadequate standard given the I&I problems we have in Columbia. And if they continue, and you want to trust them, God help us all. And the fact is, I tend to think this applies to some other kinds of thinking. But here, this is the first ward. This is the Flat Branch in particular. We should not be allowing anything. We don't have that capacity. I don't care what they say or what Mr. Mathis says about doing this. We know it's not going to help to have the release sewer on this. We have the backups in the basement. You need to call in the CDC, health agencies, and have them assess the level of the threat, maybe to convince you. But what it really amounts to is you are going to have to step in and direct the staff about the standard that you think you want and say, this is the threat. We need to prevent that. You figure out the standard to apply. Don't come and tell us what your engineering stuff told you. That is a beginning and is not enough. And we have the evidence of it's not being enough. Thank you. I know you can do it.
Eugene Elkin, 3406 Range Line. We know we've talked about the infrastructure repeatedly. I'm going to add something new tonight. When the lady was just speaking, no one seems to repeat the section of town that might be in this condition is the older section. We have tropicality, I'm not saying it correctly, the lay of the land incorrectly. We know that most systems of sewage we're talking about gravity driven. Is it possible after what Mr. Clark just said that we have 2 to 3 times it has to go up? Are we needing a pumping system to clean up First Ward or wherever this is a very bad detrimental situation? We can sit around and discuss whose house is and whose house isn't, but we haven't stepped up to try something. How about pumping it instead of just counting on gravitational pull? I often speak on homelessness. I attended the home show this past Saturday. The subject of tiny homes comes up, as we have been talking about in discussions. I found it quite interesting that the business located on North Providence, as you cross over I-70 on the right-hand side, they say within 2 weeks we'll see the first tiny home. I assume they mean just sitting on the parking lot to look at. They say it. Let's go see what they're talking about. And a business out of Fulton, Missouri, set 2 units up against Business Loop Saturday, and they were taking old barn boards, reconstruction of the same thing we do with Habitat, keeping it out of the landfill. They built tiny homes out of old barn boards. Everybody, I won't judge no one. I'm just saying there's different ways, and that opens up the page of discussion. There was a lady there that was so excited about them in the state of California. She just kept going on and on about other states that are getting on board with tiny homes. We've had 4 homeless deaths approximately since December. I think Mr. Trapp's attempt is very important. He works in the area of abuse. If our homeless are being taken out by way of drug usage, we've got to get to the bottom of this issue. We had one in December being a lady. We had one outside the church was definitely drugs. The subject K2 keeps coming up. We had one at 63 and 70. We had another here in the last few days. We have not got it completely diagnosed. Situation, a young boy, been on our streets from my beginning, and he got a job, worked 2 days, and was found deceased in his motel room, 3rd day. I cannot stress enough about the drug usage. It's in the paper, Columbia, Missouri, within the last 3 days. It was flashed in front of me this morning. Why is Fulton attached to our electricity? We've still not got to the bottom of the high usage of another city coming on board. Thank you.
Anyone else? We'll move to council comments. I want to just briefly say something to the public. I think the council's aware of this. We're certainly aware of the sewer infrastructure problem, and I think just to remind the public through the reporters, we passed a $33 million sewer bond issue, which $19 million of it was I&I work. And one of the documents that I doubt if anybody outside of our council reads is the capital improvement program. It's a 600-page document, very detailed list of projects that are planned over the next 2, 5, and 10 years. And the 10-year capital improvement program has $140 million worth of sewer work on it. And the maps show that this is heavily focused on the first and four wards. That's where the focus is. That's where clay pipes that were put in 50 to 100 years ago. You know, the new stuff is put in with PVC pipe that probably lasts 100 years. But, you know, that's part of the price of being a citizen. I've got PVC pipes. My sewer bills help subsidize the correction of the old sewer structure in the first and fourth ward. That's the price of citizenship. It's a public health issue. It's something we are very aware of. The other problem is that Aldea Street, as I am told, is in a long-term floodplain, and there are a couple of areas in the old first ward where some homes, unfortunately, were placed in places where flooding is highly likely because of being allowed in places that really wouldn't be under current regulations. That still doesn't mean it's not a problem that we have to deal with.
I had a couple comments. One is my understanding is that we had addressed a lot of the I&I in the first ward already in looking at storm water into the sewer system. Is that true? And could we perhaps get a report on that to see where we've actually gone? Because I thought we had looked at some of these.
Yeah, would love to update you on where we've come. There has been significant I&I work done in one of our basins. We have a lot of basins. We're I would say, on the early phases of the work we need to do. But we started with the worst parts of the system. It is now we've gotten through enough of it that we've looked at it, and it's had a significant improvement in backup. So it's, I think it, if I remember the number right, we had a 48% reduction in the volume of liquid coming through the sewer system when it rained. That's a huge improvement. So I&I works is what that means. And as we keep doing this work, we will catch up on it. So that work's progressing. We've also, I think we invested $70 million total in the sewer treatment facility. And we have capabilities we did not have before. And one of those is that we can pump a lot more through during rain events. Staff has been utilizing that system to do that, and we've had far fewer sanitary sewer overflows since we've begun that process. So we'll overview all of that for you in the report.
Okay, I'd appreciate that. And then someone just asked me about the election last week that, you know, we have an election in March, and then we're going to have one again in April. And the $100,000 or so that it costs for an election, is that what it costs us for the roll cart election, or because we're piggybacking it onto a primary, does it less?
We were given an invoice for $118,000 for that election. So we then true up after the fact and get the final bill. So I don't have the final numbers for you, but that was their guess as to what it would be.
We didn't have any choice either, did we? It had to be legally,
charter,
it had to be the very next election.
The charter says once received and that it shall be the next available election. So. It is expensive.
Do we ever ask Wendy Noren? How, I mean, what would it have cost her for a primary if we were not involved? I mean, you would think if you're piggybacking it on that we would
seems
be sharing
$100,000 more. Too. I think it's a great
question. That is a shared cost. The city clerk and I both had a conversation with her, and it is a shared cost as it relates to. They allocate the cost based upon the polling places when you put something on the ballot. So let's say in April, if the school district has something on the ballot with us, then those costs get split proportionately, and Sheila might be able to speak a little bit more as to the calculation method, but it's certainly more expensive when it comes to a primary or the national elections, just because they produce a lot more ballots because you get higher turnout and they have to staff more fully. So, you know, they don't want to be caught shorthanded at the polling places without adequate facilities for voters. So they're always going to make sure that they have sufficient resources there for the voters in a primary and national election, because it's a little bit harder to determine.
And I can send you all the prepayment costs for the spreadsheet that we were provided for the last couple elections, so you can, and the total, that way you can kind of visualize how the costs are spread out.
Okay, thanks.
Nothing for me.
I have just about three things, I think. There was a mention by one of the folks here about tiny homes. We did have a preliminary meeting about tiny homes. It's something that I've kind of latched onto, but there is a process that is proceeding to put on a demonstration project over with the outdoor market and so on, and over at the ARC. Eventually, we're in the planning stages of that. The tiny homes are going to be featured, and there'll be some information and maybe some forums and so on and so forth. That requires lots of complex thinking in terms of zoning exceptions and all kinds of other things, maybe even building codes and whatnot. We don't really know at this point, but we're just in the planning stages of that. Just something to look for, and it will be put out there. One other thing that came to my attention very recently, actually my daughter sent me an email the other day, and I sent it to the city clerk because she distributed it to the rest of the council. I assume you saw it, and also to the city manager and to the police chief. My daughter's a police officer in Columbus, Ohio, and she was taking part in a program that they call Blue Courage. And I didn't know anything about this program. In response to that email to the city council and everyone else, the chief actually responded and said they had been looking into this thing about Blue Courage. Blue Courage is kind of a morale-building exercise, and it also emphasizes the good things that the force in blue does. The very kinds of things that we need, and I think maybe the chief is on it. I wish I would have heard that from the chief too, rather than just get it from my daughter. But nonetheless, I think they're aware of it. It's just a brief kind of description on their website. Blue Courage says it's a transformational 2-day leadership development workshop designed for all levels of the organization. This revolutionary educational process is designed to touch hearts, awaken minds, and ignite spirits through dynamic presentations and the learning process. If your interest is self-improvement, increased in gain, well, it goes on and on. But you see what I'm talking about in terms of the police force. It's the very kind of thing that we seem to be dealing with and may even enable us to get a much better handle on community policing, given the resources that we have. I think morale building within our police department is something that we really should be on top of. I would like to look more into this and cooperate and work with the police chief. I know he's sending someone to become one of the train, or at least that was the indication that he has been given. I think we're making progress in spite of the fact that we got defeated with that proposal in 2014. for more police officers. We have kind of retooled, and we're making great progress in terms of the new police station on the north side in an area that we desperately need, and an east side substation as well, which can prevent some of the spillover crime from the demerit area. So we're doing what we can. I think we're going to have to ask the public at some point and probably sell the public on a way to at least get a few more police officers, maybe not the 40 or 50 that we wanted in the first place, but that's something in the future. And let me end on just a high note. I was very pleased that since we started off with this theme, a third ward theme, I'll end with a third ward theme, and that is, and actually it affects one of my constituents, the mayor, as well, because he lives, he is the beneficiary of living next to the Hominy Branch Phase 1 trail, and the Hominy Branch Phase 2 trail broke ground, essentially. They started on it on the 21st, second day of spring, I guess, with a projection to be finished with it this fall, which will extend the Woodridge Trail underneath I-70 to the Lynx Golf Course Trail. And ultimately, that one connects with or almost connects with Indian Hills. The Lynx, when we negotiated the Lynx trail with that golf course, private development, we made sure that when we rezoned that property that they agreed that there would be public access. So this is really kind of a nice public-private partnership, and this news, this press release indicated that they're finally we're nearing completion on that part of the trail, which will eliminate some of the isolation that has occurred on the northeast side. So I'm very happy to hear that, and I think, you know, progress in government is always incremental, but it's nice to see these benchmarks and these things get finished. So, and just one other tiny comment. You know, I have to disagree to some degree with Mr. Clark when he starts suggesting that our professional staff doesn't know what they're doing. I think they do know what they're doing. They, you know, you can make the argument, I think, that they may not take as broad an approach as you might want to take, but when it comes to the nitty-gritty of the ins and outs of sewage, I trust those people, and I there are other considerations, and we have to think sometimes a little bit more broadly, but I think that's an unfair statement. So, thank you.
I have a couple of things this evening. First of all, I have a request from a constituent on Club Meadows Drive. Apparently, there's a car that keeps parking on the street and blocking the area near the stop sign. So many of the neighbors are wondering how they could maybe just initiate no parking on a specific side of the street. I have the contact information for that individual that I could share with staff after the meeting this evening. Back on the beginning of the month, I have a request from a constituent at 4601 Vista View Terrace, and apparently he has gone through four water meters that have broken over the course of him living at this home, and he says that the meters keep breaking, something is happening to them and causing water to go through his yard, and it's now wearing away at his sidewalk. And so, of course, he's wanting his sidewalk to be repaired by the city because he's wondering, why do I keep getting meters that are breaking? And I don't know what could cause a meter to break so consistently at one resident. So I would like staff to look into this. Again, it's 4601 Vista View Terrace. If they can kind of get me the history on the issues and maybe have somebody go out and look at the sidewalk and see if it, in fact, is washing away his yard and damaging his sidewalk. And then I've been gone a lot, and somehow I was going through my paperwork, and I found a letter from back in December, but I know we're going to be coming up to this issue, and it's from a sign association regarding our new planning and zoning regulations as it relates to sign ordinances. And so if I may give this three-page letter to staff and have them comment on, because I know that issue will be coming up to us sometime this year as we look at those new planning and zoning codes. Just an issue that's so dear to my heart, transmission lines. I was going through the Public Power magazine a while back, and they were talking about alternatives. And apparently the state of Maine requires utilities considering transmission upgrades to also consider non-transmission alternatives. So as I know this issue will be coming back before us, if staff, I can share, give this magazine to whomever. And then if I could, and I think it would be beneficial just for staff to give the council as we move forward, maybe after the election here in April, what is the timeline going to be for the new planning and zoning code, public hearings and the process? Because I've had people starting to contact me who are concerned that they're only going to maybe have 3 minutes to approach the council at a public hearing to express their concerns. We're going to have to try and sit here and go through all of that when that comes before us. And I just think that will be a very unfair process for all of us involved. And so I'd like to know what our plans are moving forward, if we're going to have any work sessions with stakeholders. And I know some of the people that I've talked to that are involved with the CID, and they've hired their own consultant to go through those zoning codes to see and compare it with what our consultants have done and others to what they find. And so, again, if staff could let us know what that process will be in the future so we can all be prepared for it. And that's all I have. Thank you.
I had a couple of things. Last meeting, Rhonda Carlson from Buildings and Construction Codes Commission made some remarks. We had some email follow-up based upon my remarks during council comments. One idea that she had that I think might have merit is to have someone, an energy efficiency expert, added to the building and construction codes. I look because there's perennial openings on the building and construction codes already, but they're all alternate members. Looks like it's fully staffed, and most of the alternates are staffed, so there are a lot of the trades that are underrepresented, but that one, at least all the primary members are fully staffed. So that's something for staff to consider. I told her that I would echo her request. And then as we look at the phase two of the pawn shop ordinance to try to bring in other secondhand providers, Gary Taylor from Music Around Columbia, I may have emailed all of us, but I reached out to him since I had been championing this thing, and we've had some email correspondence. And so if we do have any kind of stakeholder process, which I think would be a good idea, as we formulate, I think a report is the next step for that proposal. He'd like to be involved in that process. He was sitting on a stolen guitar right now and had lost track of who was the current officer in charge. So I emailed the information that Leah Christian expertly tracked down for me over the course of the meeting. So I let him know who our civilian investigator in charge of that is. So there's a lot that we need to do in regards to tracking down and stolen goods. So looking forward to a process over the next few months.
Councilman Ruffin?
Yeah, I have just two things. One, I know that it seems that we focus primarily on our police officers in terms of race and culture diversity training. And so I'm just curious to know if there is a specific plan for city staff or perhaps even the city council to participate in workshops of this nature going forward so that we can all speak with the same vocabulary as we're talking about some of the more pertinent issues that are impacting our community. So just hadn't heard anything. Would just like to know if we're planning on doing anything about that in the coming year. The second thing I wanted to share, too, is that when Tracy Wilson-Kleekamp spoke about the presentation that was made by Brian Stevenson, who's the author of the book Just Mercy. The first principle he spoke of was we must be willing to get closer to the issue. And there are so many ways of doing that. I just wanted to put it out there that this week the Central Missouri Community Action Organization is sponsoring a special event, 100 Man Luncheon. They're asking 100 men to volunteer to go to the Head Start programs that are primarily in the First and Second Ward, Bear Creek and Worley and Park Street, during the lunch hour, and spend some one-on-one time with a child there. Read a story with them, and they'll give you a free lunch. So that's Wednesday and Thursday of this week. So just want to put that out there. I feel that that gets us closer to the real issues. Amen.
Hey, it's still the same day.
Same day.